Bill?
Well, I was going to try to put forward a specific proposal for consideration. And I'll do it as a package and I'll brief rationale. That we go with PSI 12, number 450, as the outcome measure. It seems that that's the best single outcome measure. Recommend also that we include VTE 6, number 376, but with an asterisk. The asterisk being the technical issues, and then we recognize that it may need to be fixed, and we defer to the expertise in CSAC about how best to address that. We think that the concept of this measure is important, one, because it is outcome-related, and also because, as James reminded me, this one is broader than the first one because it includes medical as well as surgical patients. So I think it's another rationale for doing this one. And then the other two to include would be the last two on the full list here, number 581 and number 593. While these are process measures, they are the only ones that really apply to the clinician and the health plan population level, outside the hospital. And although they aren't ideal, we need something to cover those populations. So that would take, in terms of being the partial learning goal, going from 10 measures down to 4 measures. Those are what I'd be recommending the top 4.
All right. Jane?
I agree with Bill's recommendation and would add for the last two, 581 and 593, that NQF look at adding another element to those measures in that the patient not only is treated for 3 months but maintained within a therapeutic range as well. Because, I mean, if they're on anticoagulation for the 3 months but they're leaving.
So can I just hold that one over as a gap?
Okay, yes. Yes.
Okay. And we'll get into gaps, but that, I think, is an excellent point. Anne Marie?
Yes, to look at measures that extend beyond just the hospital. So while they're not perfect, I think they're a beginning of doing that. And my only question is, to some extent, how you gather the data, you know, and how you're intending to get out there and pick it up. I mean, health plans clearly have it. And I guess you can gather it through pharmacy and getting back to clinicians. So there's probably a way to do it. And so, but I do think that those are really important if we're going to extend it. And I tend, even though I like the science of all the ones, the process measures, I think if you're going to try to thin it down, you should probably go for outcome and, you know, let the process measures have to be done by the people in order to get the good outcomes as a general way of looking at these, if you want to slim them down. And I think most places now that are working on DVT have adopted these process measures because that's the only thing, I mean, you've got to do that. So then it's the outcome. And so I think if you stick with outcomes and then maybe some process on the outpatient side, because we're not there yet, with some of the direct outcomes, it makes sense. So I agree with the choices.
Great. Nancy?
So I think I'm in agreement, too, but I want to probe a little bit more on what Anne-Marie was just asking about. How do these data get collected on the left to the 581 and 593?
It's administrative claims and pharmacy data.
And do we know the degree of reliability there? Are we going to get an accurate picture?
I would have to see if I can pull up the submission form and see if I can. Let me see if I can find that. They've been reviewed. It was a few years ago under clinically enriched, so may take some digging.
Sorry about that. But my concern, obviously, is that it's not going to give us an accurate picture. We're not going to get the result we want. But thanks.
Right. Just a quick question on that. Heidi, if it's administrative claims data in the public sector, there's probably less of a problem. In the private sector, not everybody has a prescription plan.
Right. And that is correct. So we're actually seeing developers looking at that issue. Whether we have it on these measures, I don't know, but often they will look and see the rate of the ones that, looks like 20 months, but don't think, go ahead.
Thanks, Heidi. So
I will channel a little bit of my past experience. So I was, prior to joining the National Quality Forum, I was part of Resolution Health and WellPoint, and that is the measure steward for these two measures. So, you know, when these were submitted under the clinically enriched ambulatory, you know, claims-based measures, to get to your question, Nancy, about how do we know if someone has pharmacy, you know, data available. So part of the specs in the measure is to look at for the individuals whether they demonstrate pharmacy eligibility. So in terms of the claims, you can see if they have eligibility for pharmacy services, and if that is a yes, then they can proceed through the rest of the measure to look for the presence of these medications. So if someone does not have, so in terms of for the measure, if a patient does not have eligibility for pharmacy services, we cannot look at that absence, you know, in our claims data to say, we're sure that person didn't get it or they didn't get it some other way or what, we can't do that. So it's to, again, look at people who have that available, you know, have the pharmacy benefit and say, you know, did that person follow through and actually have the medication that's needed?
Well, if I could just follow up, Frank, I understand what you're saying, Connie, and I appreciate that. Do we have any sense of what proportion of the population we have pharmacy data on, and given that, do we have any sense as to whether there are gaps that we ought to be concerned about and comment on, perhaps in our report? For example, if impoverished populations tend to not have pharmaceutical coverage more than well-heeled populations, I'd like to know that.
So, again, we can, if there is a question mark here, we can push that into the gap file. Okay. I have Barbara next. Okay. Laura?
Yeah. I just want to kind of take us back a step, and it might help us prioritize. If we look at, as part of the safety committee, are we looking at prevention, or are we looking at treatment after the bad event happens? And that's sort of the theme I'm hearing here. We can look at preventing the DVD from the beginning, or are we looking at the treatment? I think it's both, but I think we have to sort of put that out there as well as the safety committee. And while our priority is to prevent, we also want to look at measurements that also treat appropriately, because that will prevent further decompensation too. So, I mean, just a thought. It might help us prioritize a little bit, and you know, it's probably all over the page on that one. But
so does that mean you're in support of the process measures?
I'm to prevent. Yes, if we're looking at, as a safety committee, to prevent the bad outcomes, then you want to look at process. If you want to look at once you've got the bad outcome, then that's more treatment, and you're preventing it from getting worse, but you're not really preventing the bad event in the first place. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Richard?
Yeah, so I would add support to the proposal. I think the first two actually make a nice pair in terms of looking at the reality. Also, I'd like to just mention that it is true that the PSI 12 is a more narrow population, but that doesn't worry me too much, because it seems if the hospital is able to get its processes in place and could really impact the population most at risk, which is the surgical population, it probably will extend throughout, because of the protocol-driven nature of medicine and the team-based nature. It may be true that the internist may have missed that class or something and they're not using prophylaxis, but in general, I would think that one would imply the other. So I'm actually pretty confident of that. So I support that. And I would, though, I don't know if there is a risk-adjusted version and a non-risk, but I would certainly urge us to use the risk-adjusted measure here.
Sean?
It's been a while since I had to review this, but I am still concerned, and I will say this one more time, that in the current status of our approach to the prevention of thromboembolic events, the actual incidence of pulmonary embolus in hospitals is relatively pretty small. The incidence of DVT is pretty big, but the actual incidence of PE is pretty small. And because it is such a rare event, that you'll see it in large hospitals, you won't see it very often in small hospitals, and that any measure tied to the outcome of pulmonary embolus, which is hard, relatively hard to miss, but still missable, as compared to DVT, which is very underdiagnosed, you know, and often diagnosed when people leave, concerns me a lot. I think that for very, very large hospitals, you'll see it. In smaller hospitals, you may not. And just the fact that you haven't detected it doesn't mean that you're doing a good job and doing good patient care. So I do have a worry about using that as an outcome variable.
So, Sean, you, I'm looking at the outcome measure, and I kind of look at the second measure as an outcome measure, 450 and 376. Are you speaking to those two measures?
I'm sorry. I'm speaking to 450, which I think because we know that DVT is very underdiagnosed and missed, and pulmonary embolus is such a rare event that we're not going to see it in smaller hospitals, or we're going to see it as a late outcome from an undiagnosed DVT. So I'm speaking to 450. To come back, Frank, I took my time. I agreed with your rationale and your reasoning on 376. I mean, I think when it happens, we've got to do a root cause analysis, and it really is a major problem. So I do agree with your reasoning on that. But I do have trouble with 450, which has been discussed.
So then if I flip your statement, does that mean you're more focused on the process measures?
For this particular disease, I'm more focused on the process measures.
And as a composite, is that those six, or is there any one particular?
I don't want to go back and redo it. I think the six is probably the best that have been put forward as a composite measure. I mean, there are pros and cons. But I'm not sure that I would go back and redo the committee's work on that. They certainly looked at this and endorsed it.
Okay. Tom?
Yes, I'm just concerned that we need to have something other than Connie's measure there from Resolution Health. For the ambulatory side, because certainly we do have patients who should be on prophylaxis, who come in with a pulmonary embolus, who are outside of the hospital setting. I'm not aware of any measure, though, aside from this one Resolution Health one. Are there any? Mine's more of a question.
What's in the big file? We have to go to the big Excel file to see what we've left on the table. Our discussion guide's got a more narrow focus. While we're doing that, we're right at the lunch hour and actually pushed a little bit past it. I think we have a very good consensus without having to vote and force a vote on this to frame some thoughts and comments on our side with this. I have one outstanding question before we break for lunch for Bill. If I could ask him on the HIT measure, 374, the steering committee did not recommend this process measure, which was a process related to the complications from heparin therapy.
Heidi and I were trying to reconstruct that when it came up earlier. My recall, despite what you said, Frank, was I thought there was a belief that this was an idiosyncratic reaction and monitoring wouldn't do much. We've also got we had a couple of other problems with that measure as well. That's on a different screen. Yeah. So the the struggle with the relatively weak connection between the process being measured and the desired outcome in this instance. Also, the committee emphasized that measuring whether or not a nomogram is used does not capture the more important question of whether the patient's anticoagulation was adequate and within therapeutic range.
Okay.
So they had several problems with this measure.
All right. So what I'd like to do at this point is take our break for lunch, and while you're having that lunch break, start thinking about the gaps. I think we've had a very good discussion on what we want to include, and I think it's probably teed up a lot of thoughts about where you want to look at gaps. And the way to frame the gaps goes back to the original framework of the families and thinking about the different care settings across the continuum. What are we missing for the best and safe, the most safe care for patients with this disease across the continuum? And then we'll put together some general comments about gaps. We don't have to go into any real detail. We want to capture the high notes of where you think the gaps are, and we can dig further in the future. So where is our lunch? It's over here. I can't see it. All right. So why don't we just go ahead and take the next 20, 25 minutes for our lunch break. Have we started to pull ourselves back together? In the next couple minutes, we'll get started again, and we'll open with gaps and then go to public comment on this this group. We identified a lot of areas in the family, in the subtopic area of ETE, that we'd like to have measures, and I think it was a great discussion, but it's time now to capture those specific gap areas that you think we need to report back to the coordinating committee where we think there are issues. And so let me just open up, for the group, and we'll create a laundry list of these and then try and pull them together in a report. Nancy.
Thanks, Frank. So one of the questions the staff posed at the top of our list was about pediatric population, and I think we do need to think about how one can effectively extend these measures to the pediatric population. But I, for one, am not comfortable suggesting that they simply be extended as they are currently developed. I think we need to make sure that they are appropriately tested, embedded in the pediatric population first before being used. So that would be a measure development gap.
Okay. Tom, you look like you're ready to say something over there.
Thank you. You can read me, can't you? Are you talking about this particular one? Because half of my training is in pediatrics, and it is a very rare phenomenon, except in children who have blood dyscrasias, to have this as an issue. It's not the same thing as in my internal medicine.
So you're saying the incident? Sorry, Frank. You're saying the incidence is so small, it would not really be a safety question as far as you're concerned.
Smaller than the people that we're talking about.
I stand corrected.
No pun intended. So thinking across the continuum, in pre-acute care, and then in the post-acute care and home environment, let's start in the beginning of the continuum before people are in the acute care setting. Are there gaps that we need to consider for VTE? Sean?
Long-term care.
Okay. So those people who are in a chronic care setting, and what are we doing to measure and track, identifying, preventing? Okay.
And I guess the other high-risk population, which may not be this committee, is the oncology centers and cancer patients. Those are the other high-risk, probably high-risk group that we're not capturing.
Excellent. In the acute care setting, so we talked about a lot of measures, but I don't know that everyone was totally happy with the measures we talked about. Are there any other gap areas that we need to identify within acute care? Jane?
I believe the Joint Commission has PEDVT prophylaxis for C-section as well.
Yep. Okay. And the last area would be then the Lance?
want to check to make sure that we don't have a gap in regards to something that's related to PSI 12, and that would be PSI 90, the patient safety composite metric, which actually includes PSI 12, if I'm not mistaken. So is that a potential gap in the acute care arena?
In the back part.
I think you included it on the spreadsheet that you sent us, the Excel spreadsheet, but I don't see it on this discussion guide. So I'm not sure if I'm out of order here or is that.
You mean the patient safety for selected indicators measure?
Yeah.
It's on the very last page of the discussion guide. There's actually two composites that are just kind of dangling out there a little bit, but they are on the back page. If folks want to take a look at.
So I guess we'll discuss that later in a different focus area?
We can. It's part of they tend to cover a wide variety of safety issues that 531 covers several safety issues that cross various agenda items. So as the group discusses how they want to be using composites, this is certainly a composite that should come up for discussion.
And then in the post-acute care setting, LTAC, skilled nursing, do we have any gap areas to identify? And then finally, a broad topic that we talked a lot about this morning earlier was the care coordination area, and do we have gaps to identify for VTE care coordination? Richard?
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's a gap with medication reconciliation, but we might want to measure adherence to the medication, because that speaks to education of the patient, and we might want to measure adequate monitoring of therapeutic levels, because that can present a real problem if that's not followed carefully.
And is that post care? Is that across all settings?
I think that would be across all settings. It's mostly post acute care.
Okay. So. Couple areas there in terms of appropriate coordination, appropriate dosing, appropriate patient tracking, follow-up. Shaq?
Thanks, Frank. I would agree with Richard. I think monitoring is a huge component, and not only because of VTEs, but also bleeds. So I would also.
Okay. Tom?
I thought ambulatory care was not the same thing as post-acute care, but in this situation, it really is. And Richard's picked right up on the big ones, other than one thing is drug interaction. Warfarin particularly is one that's so subject to that there should be using claims-based data to look at what the concomitant drugs are.
Very good. Jane?
I'm just thinking now, what about ambulatory surgical centers? Are they an entity that's touched by this measure set?
I guess your question is if the patient needs it, we need to cover across all those settings. So we can do that. They don't.
Yeah.
All right, so there's a gap. Okay. So any other comments on gaps on this one? Well, then let me, if I could, open up for public.
Sorry, Bill.
Would you want to pick up on some of ours? I think you really covered them, but there were three that we had identified. One is to expand to all inpatients, not just surgical ones, for an outcome measure. And we even thought maybe ARC could be engaged to expand 450 in some way, cover all categories. The second was to extend into extended care facilities, the post-acute facilities for a measure like that. And then long-term, either a recurrent, an outcome measure like a recurrence rate or a process measure like appropriate treatment like it's been covered here would be very helpful.
Great. Thank you. Jane, did you have some? Okay. So hearing no more other gap areas identified, let me then open up to public comment first in the room. Do we have any public comment in the room? And seeing none, could we open up the phone lines for public comment?
At this time, to make a comment, please press star 1. There are no comments over the phone.
Thank you very much. Great. Well, we got through one. And hopefully we'll have learned a lot from that as we move on to the next, which is the healthcare-associated infections. And commenting in this area, we have Anne-Marie, Tom James, Richard Bringawatt, and Foster Gaston. So Anne-Marie, ladies first.
These are obviously the infection, and I think they fit all the key, at least the concept fits all the key criteria. And I think the main ones which make sense to include are the ones that are outcome-based, that basically talk about the outcome for all the device-related as well as C. difficile and the MRSA. So I think it makes sense to be monitoring that across the systems and to make sure that people keep those infection rates down. There's a couple that are process-related, like the bundle, and I tend to think we could maybe think of those a little bit like the process-related ones in the previous discussion, and maybe you might not want to include those as for everybody. Obviously, if you're going to prevent infections, you use the bundle or you use one of these prevention methods. So I would tend to think that we should stay, again, with the outcomes, which are basically the infection rates. And I think the infection rates across all services in a hospital and including various rehab facilities and long-term care facilities. So you just look at the infection rates everywhere from these things, and you don't just say ICUs, or there were a couple here that included, like, specifically looking at an ICU, which I don't think is that helpful. You should look across all your services. Any place you're doing these things, you should see if you have infections, and then you should look at the outcome rates. So that's the ones for the, basically for the infections. Then if you get to the SCIF, which are the surgical, these are all process measures. By and large, I think we all, certainly in the hospital systems, we do these, and they've been, I think, very successful and very useful, but they're process. But you could keep them as a group. Everybody kind of does them, I think, pretty much as a group. The one is the, we dropped it out of here, the one that was one of the things I think about shaving or something isn't here, because that's been controversial. But of this group, these are the classic, but they are, again, process, not outcome. And then similarly, the ones for cardiac surgery are, again, pretty much process. The ventilator-assisted pneumonias are, I think, outcome. You're looking at whether or not you have a ventilator-assisted pneumonia. And, again, the ventilator bundle is a process one linked to that, so I don't know if you need that one if you're going to have a specific outcome for ventilator-assisted pneumonia. So, again, I think my thoughts were to keep it primarily on the outcome measures, slim down some of the process measures, but I wasn't exactly sure about all those SCIP measures, which everybody's doing. I don't know. I didn't know whether you should throw those out or keep those in. That was what I wasn't sure about.
Thank you. And just one question on the ventilator-assisted pneumonia. That one I have listed as a target population of pediatrics. Are you thinking about that in pediatrics or expansion into adults?
I think that should be in adults. I mean,
it's 140.
Yeah, ventilator, you're right. Actually, you're right. The ventilator bundle is in the adult, but I think it should be the outcome measure in adults as well, basically, the infection rate, not just the ventilator bundle.
Okay, thank you. Tom?
I agree completely. But the other things to add, I've already mentioned, I think that we should be thinking in terms of VRE to be added to these other infections. The urinary tract infections, there is also a measure for ambulatory urinary tract infection prevention. Certainly, it's a big issue in the long-term care facility. So this the UTI, and there is one, Nancy, in pediatrics, too, because you're dealing with a different set of physiology and anatomy in that situation. So urinary, the Claudia is a good one for being able to cross multiple spectra on this. The skip measures, and I didn't mean to skip over that, but, Frank, you're really the one who's in the best position to do that. I did not see surgical timeout on here. I have had some understanding that some of the skip measures are not necessarily associated with improved surgical outcomes. But I think, Frank, you're clearly in a much better position than I am, and I'm just a plea. And we've already talked about with the ventilator-associated pneumonias that there is a pediatric measure which is outcomes-based and then a process-based combination measure that's for the adults. It would be nice to get these things harmonized. I've learned that term here in Washington. Stingy? Does it mean stingy? And the central line associated infection, that is a terrific one. That's one where I think there's been great improvement, and I'd love to see that one keep moving on that one.
Great. Richard?
Yeah, I'm going to defer mostly to my colleagues here in terms of looking specifically at a number of these measures. I think more of my forte is going to come in relation to care coordination and the second part of this. But I do have a few comments here. One is, and it probably fits more in terms of where there may be some gaps, but again, clearly there is a heavy focus here in terms of hospital and medically related and gaps in relation to long-term care and post-acute care in terms of these kind of measures. Then secondly is in special needs plans, there are some special needs plans that exclusively focus on defined populations. And so one question that is always important for me to ask is in relation to any one of these measures, is there any adverse effect or is there, something that implies something negative? As an example, just give some examples. Some plans exclusively serve people in nursing homes or exclusively serve frail elders or exclusively serve people with ESRD or severe and persistent mental illness or people with AIDS. So it's important for me to put in front of my colleagues a lens to look at these measures through those different, from those different vantage points to see whether there's anything that can't be taken care of through some sort of risk adjustment methodology and where there's a possible adverse effect or something needs to be modified because of a target population, or if you're doing a comparison of what's going on with a particular subset and you specialize in a certain area and do a comparison of that group with people who have very few of those conditions, what does that measurement do to appropriate comparison? It may be that the population you're serving
you have a worse set of outcomes than what exists for a general population, but for the population you're targeting, it's actually quite good. So I think some of those things need to be taken into account as we look at these measures. But on first glance, the measures seem to be important ones from a medical standpoint, but I'm going to defer to my colleagues here in terms of the specificity on them.
Great. Thank you. Foster, are you there?
I am here. Thank you. So I thought this was a good list of measures, and I like the prioritization that was described on the two-pager. I guess just to pile on to other folks who've made similar comments, I would agree. It's clear that the focus is on the inpatient side, and I think that there's whatever that can be done to look at non-hospital-based sites, including office-based surgery or outpatient, I think would be an advance in terms of broadening the scope of these measures. But these are many standardized measures that are important that, I'm familiar, at least in our state, that we've been looking at some of these and showing improvement over time. There's some science behind being able to do the improvement, which is good. So a couple of comments, additional comments that weren't mentioned, pile on a little bit. In terms of the first question about C. difficile, again, I would just comment that we're seeing this as a real and growing problem, and so there's a question on the page about whether it should be included or not. It's currently undergoing NQF endorsement, and I would say I would vote yes for that. Similarly for MRSA, although my colleagues here tell me this is somewhat of less of an issue lately than it's been previously. In terms of surgical site infections, again, echoing what other people have said, I think in terms of trying to look for parsimony, I think it would look forward to a conversation about the relative value of looking at the process measures versus looking at outcome measures. That's presuming that there are measures, and there's a question here about whether that procedure-specific measures, whether there is a well-worn methodology for being able to do adequate risk adjustment. I'm familiar with what we're doing here in New York in terms of looking at colon surgical site infections and cabbage graft infections and hip replacement. I think we've recently started this past year our plan to do hysterectomy surgical site infections, and I know that there's a risk-adjustment methodology to that, but I really don't know whether there is, in fact, sort of a nationalized way of going about that, and I assume that might be some of the challenge. But, again, would welcome a conversation about whether the focus on this should be process-oriented or whether it should be more outcome-oriented. I think that's pretty much the comments that I have about the measures, and so I'll defer to others and look forward to the conversation.
Great. Thank you very much. Let me turn to Bill and Heidi for any other updates. There's certainly a lot of comments in the column here about submitted and endorsed.
If we can keep it short, all of these outcome measures were what I call highly endorsed, and they're very important. They're highly valid and reliable. They were useful, understandable. The only in our assessment grid, I just ran through, the only weakness might be their feasibility. They're pretty costly and labor-intensive to measure, but it's an important topic as well. So every one of those outcome measures is there. I'm completely crushed because somehow the summary here left out measure 753. And one of our great accomplishments as a committee, we actually got the CDC and the American College of Surgeons to work together in a harmonized surgical site infection measure, and it's not in the summary here. So that could avoid the process measures associated with SCIP. But that was a great accomplishment. It took over a year for them to get together and do that.
Okay. It's important to note that I did not ask him to make that statement. But I thank you for making that statement. I think you got left off the list just because it's a small population compared to some of these others, but it's still an important population. So You say the magic word, and it goes back. So then let's open this up for discussion and see where you want to go with this.
So that measure, I just want to say that measure is on the large Excel file. We had filtered it out from the discussion guide because of the small. It's only addressing colon surgeries and abdominal hysterectomies now, this harmonized version. So it's a much smaller patient population. But as with all the measures on the Excel file, it's still completely in play to be included if you like to include it within a safety measure family, not to diminish the hard work of the harmonization effort in any way.
They're also, and frankly, to be closer to it, they're working to expand the number of procedures that they're producing as well.
Dolores?
Well, that was one of the things I was going to ask. What happened to the surgical site infection? Is that the surgical site infection and it got disappeared, you say, because not enough of it happens?
No, no.
Of course.
Now, when you look at the volume of these other events,
yeah.
You know, we're talking about 290,000 infections versus 15,000 infections. So it's just a small number. It is an important thing to consider, and putting it on the list is not a problem.
So it's going back on?
I think it's officially on.
Hmm?
I think I've heard enough comment from
Foster
and from Bill.
All right, so I don't need to ask about that one then.
Done.
But the other one is my proposal not to to reconsider the never events, which went down to flaming defeat at the last meeting, again on the grounds that the incidence was not large enough. Do I remember correctly that there was some suggestion that NQF was going to reevaluate at least some of those measures, and have they done so? There were methodological objections of some arcane measure that was over my pay grade. So I thought there was some suggestion that they were going to be looked at again, and that's been 4 or 5 months now. So what's happened?
Dolores, you're talking about the HAC.
Yes. Yeah.
So we had several safety-related projects where those measures could have come in. They did not come in. So there's very little we can do if they're not submitted to us. CMS would have to give a little better explanation as to what they were thinking. It's possible that they're pulling it off the proposed rules, and so I don't know that they're going to use them anymore, so that may be part of the reason why they didn't bring them to us. I don't know, but we did not get them in to review them. We had, the safety committee would have looked at them.
You could ask them.
We did, and we still didn't get them. So there's very little I can do to get, if a developer doesn't want to bring them forward for whatever reason it is, that's as far as we can go.
Well, maybe some of us outsiders could do something.
You're so shy.
Okay. I mean, I still think they belong in here, and I'm glad to hear that the other hacks are coming back in. That's such a terrible phrase. We have to. Okay, thanks.
Nancy?
Thanks. I think this group actually provides us with some interesting questions to deal with. First of all, I support the outcome measures being included. I support the notion that we ought to include the new surgical, not new, but the surgical site infection measure as well, the outcome measure. But I think because it covers only the two major surgeries, we might want to look at recommending some of the process measures stay because to lose all the rest of the surgeries or any look at any of the safety at all the rest of the surgeries seems to me to be problematic, just to put it that way. So, you know, the skip measures make sense to me in light of needing to look broadly at major surgeries and the potential for infection. Let me deal first with the ventilator-associated pneumonia one, which I think poses a new question for us, which is, I heard Chesley talk earlier about moving from ventilator-associated pneumonias to ventilator-associated events, in the adult population, and that makes for an interesting change. What I don't know, Chesley, and I don't know whether you know, is that same movement being made for the pediatric population or not? And as we move to make some recommendations here, how do we handle that sort of question around something that's a very important topic, but we don't yet know what the measure is? Does that go in the gap list? Does it go in the close to ready to cook list? I don't know where it goes. But and the second question I want to raise here is that as you look at a lot of the surgical site infection measures, you see that there are very similar measures constructed for application to different entities, the clinician, the hospital, the what have you. And for me, that raises the question of whether we should be thinking about how to promote more integration of that commonality you spoke to at the beginning of our meeting, Frank, about getting everybody on the same page and working towards that same outcome. Are there opportunities here where we could say where the physician, the surgeon is operating in an institution, use the institutional measure? Or is there just too much divergence in the population to make that a reliable count? But I'm looking for ways to get people on the same page. And so I'm thinking there may be some conversation around that as well. And then finally, there are a lot of additional sites that I think we're going to need to talk about expanding some of these measures to once we get to the what are the gaps conversation.
Helen?
I wanted to say several things. One is that I wanted to ask about the SSI measures. You're talking about just those two surgeries. I thought I heard some mention of it being expanded to others. Is that
right? So when they worked to combine the two measures together, they looked to see which procedures they could say using both the NHSN data and the NSQIP data were the most reliable. And those were the two that they could move forward with. Their plan is to keep moving and expanding that back to the full list of conditions or as close as they can. I'm not sure what timeline they're on. I don't know if you know that, Frank. But
is that why those two are the ones that are going to be reported?
Yes, that's why. They were the most reliable out of the two systems.
So in order to be reported, they're all going to have to be a combination of NHSN and NSQIP data?
So the way the measure works is regardless of which system you use, we can say you could really realistically the hope is comparative results.
Mm-hmm.
NSQIP is at the physician level, clinician level, and the NHSN obviously is at the facility level. So depending on what data you have access to, you can do it. I mean, at a very simple level, that's really what they're trying to do. So you can use either way that works best for you, my understanding. Does that make sense?
Yes. Okay. Yes. So we can recommend then that these be expanded to other procedures at as rapid a pace as possible.
Yes. That was pretty much what the steering committee CDP side asked as well. So it would be good.
And then the other I'm concerned about is no outcome measures for ambulatory surgery. Is that something that's being addressed?
We do have several measures that look at ambulatory surgery. Surgical site infection, I'll have to look and make sure. I don't believe that is one of them. I will look and see if I can figure out why that is. I can't remember off the top of my head.
I would think that would be the critical measure for ambulatory. And are there not existing measures for specific surgical site infections already? But we didn't include any of them unless they were.
Like total joints. Like Foster had suggested in his comments.
Yeah.
You mentioned total joint.
Yeah, I mean, my concern in general about this is even just going procedure by procedure that you still miss a lot because not every procedure makes it on. And then the other thing that I wanted to say was just to echo Doris's and Dolores's comments about the hacks, because I am concerned about taking the hacks off. I think there's something that has been really important for transparency with the public.
Tommy?
Well, I just might mention, Helen, you had that question specifically earlier about surgical site infection and in our for ambulatory surgery centers.
Mm-hmm.
So in our discussion guide, there is number 264, and it's ASC5 and prophylactic IV antibiotic timing. So looking for antibiotics ordered for surgical site infection prophylaxis and whether this was done on time.
Right.
That's
only one I saw.
That's right, yeah. So there is one example, but again, when we get to the gap.
But no outcomes measures.
So most of the discussion so far has been in strong endorsement of outcomes, but there really has not been much in terms of process, just pointing that one out. And then there's been an identification of gaps, particularly in the surgical area. All right. Is it Richard?
So I do want to say that the hospital community really has embraced the NHSN-based definitions. And a few of these are the so-called hacks. I mean, there's the CLABSI and the CAUTI. Those are so-called hacks. C. difficile, I think, might be one, too. But in any event, the hospital community likes the objective definition. The one issue that I want to ask about is this issue of the procedurally based ones, the central line and the catheter. The problem there is trying to collect up the denominator, which is the number of central line days and catheter days, which has to really be done manually in most cases. So until we have good EHRs, we wonder if it would be adequate to look at the ICU populations and whether there's a good correlation and what we really gain by looking at the entire hospital. So because that denominator is so difficult to capture. So I'd be interested in hearing a little bit about that. About the process measures, I think that the SCIP measures are necessary. The prophylactic antibiotic within 1 hour, that's been shown with good scientific evidence to reduce infections. There's no doubt about that. And the problem with looking at the infection rate is that a lot of these things don't declare themselves in the hospital. So you can have a hospital-based measure of post-operative infection, but unless you capture it in the outpatient setting, you're going to miss a lot. So I do think we need to keep these SCIP measures of prophylactic antibiotics and the discontinuation of them, which is also an important metric because it's wasteful and dangerous to keep these things running when there's no benefit. So there's good evidence to stop at 24 hours. I believe the surgery, the perioperative temperature management is actually kind of near 100% at the moment, and I'm wondering if that's true. Do we need it? But we can talk about that. And then lastly, we do need to figure out if we're going to look at ventilator-associated pneumonias or events. And my understanding is the problem with the pneumonia is there's a requirement for clinical adjudication, and people then debate whether the culture was positive before or after, and then you have these committees that are formed that override and say, no, it wasn't, whereas the event is more of an objective, ventilator changes needed to be done. There was an x-ray evidence that something has happened, so we've had an event, and whether it's a pneumonia or some other thing, it's related to the ventilator. So at least it's more objective. That's my understanding, but maybe Chesley could help us with that.
Chesley, is this related to that?
Yeah. I mean, basically the pneumonia, if you want to play games with the definition, you just call it not a pneumonia if somebody has ARDS. You call it ARDS or whatever. And if you look at the discussions that have gone around the event, the actual interventions for either prevention or treatment are very similar. So the point is, why not a measure of the event and then focus on the quality improvement in preventing the event, even though the event may be a mixture of pneumonia and other types of ventilator-associated conditions. I'll go back to the denominator issue, which I think is a critical one. It's been probably one of the most vexing issues with NHSN data, this idea that collecting the line, the exposure data, that is what really gives the added sort of validity to the measure. It's accurate collecting of the denominator and exposure data to the devices, central lines or urinary catheters or ventilators. And what I can tell you is that there is work at CDC to do estimation protocols so you don't have to collect so much of the data. That would reduce the data collection burden. There's also work in populating the electronic health records with tools and methods that would allow more automated collection of the denominator data. So I think both of those things need to be fed into. They're not ready for prime time at this point, but they need to be part of the discussion as we move forward.
Sure. Is there a correlation? I mean, is there a good correlation between what is observed generally and what's observed in the ICU? Because we know the ICU is more manageable and it's easier to collect that data.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. So the question would be, is the ICU a marker for what's going on in the rest of the hospital? I don't think there's good enough data to say that conclusively, although that's what most people are collecting. They're collecting the ICU data. I think with UTIs where you see most of the catheters actually with central lines, most of the catheter, urinary catheter and central line use is outside the ICU. So the larger part of the actual exposure to these devices is outside the ICU. And the concern has always been that we're missing a lot of infections there and a lot of quality improvement opportunities in populations that are less sick and suffer more if they get one of these infections. So I think that's why we've tried to push it to make these measures hospital-wide sort of measures. And I think that will be the general movement in NHSN is to take them out of the sort of site-specific surveillance, which occurs now in ICUs and special units, to more hospital-wide measurements. But that's contingent on some of these estimation protocols for the line and other device exposures and for the electronic health record work that we're doing. So what I would say is you've got endorsed measures now with the ways to get that's where we are now. But as I think Nancy said earlier, these are things that are ongoing at CDC and with our partners that are getting closer and closer to sort of real time. So, you know, I'm happy to facilitate a more of a briefing or a discussion or more materials to help inform the process here, but I think that's where we are.
Bill?
I just want to summarize where we're coming from on this from a consumer and purchaser perspective. We do strongly support the outcome measures. Just want to be explicit that I would include in that number 1717 and 1716, those which have been submitted but not yet endorsed, but both of those appear to be strong. That's the CDIF outcome measure and the MRSA outcome measure. I would also recommend we give a serious consideration including two bundles of process measures. One's the CLABSI bundle, which I understand from clinical evidence indicates that there's a strong link between the performance on the process, the process bundle with the outcomes, and also the ventilator bundle. And that one, both because there's clinical evidence about the link between process and outcomes, but also that's a way of including a measure for the adult population, because otherwise the ventilator assisted pneumonia in the ICU is just for the pediatric population. On SSIs, this is where I think the naughtiest problem. We don't see, from a public reporting perspective, the need for great value in reporting the existing SCIP process measures. I'm not familiar with the pros and cons of the 753 that we discussed earlier, but it sounds like a good one, and so if that's the case, we support it. But I'm still concerned about the lack of outcome measures in this category, and based on that, I think we need to add back the hack, similar to what Dolores and others have said.
Bill, did you want to follow up on?
Yeah, let me give you an update on 1716 and 17. I got so distracted by the harmony of ACS and CDC, I probably didn't pay attention to the details. But last week, the steering committee endorsed both of those pretty strongly, so I imagine they will go through the rest of the approval process pretty well.
Richard?
Yeah, I wanted to make a couple of comments here relating to everybody getting on the same page and yet at the same time need to have some accountability for a particular event. It seems to me like there's a number of where it's in a hospital setting, particularly surgically related, it seems pretty easy to kind of define where the accountability is. However, when you have some conditions, whether it may or may not be initiated, you know, whether it's MRSA or use of antibiotics or other kind of issues that are labeled here, there's a question of who should be accountable. Where is the measurement, you know, in the different particular settings, in a hospital, in a nursing home setting, in a clinic where certain kind of things are likely to show up. And so how do we deal with that question of measurement relative to the specific places, and, you know, going back to the chart that you had previously. It's hard to have general accountability. You have to have accountability someplace, but I think it behooves us to try to struggle with that to sort out really where the accountability should be for some of this. In relation to that, I think it's also useful to point out that of these measures in this set, none are specifically related to a health plan. And at what, you know, at what point should a health plan be accountable for these kind of measures? And if not, then at what level should the accountability be? It, I think, maybe fits here in terms of discussion about the gaps and application, but I think that, you know, it's something that's important for us to struggle with.
So just specifically, are you thinking of a health plan has a safety infection measure set?
I think it's reasonable to look at that. I don't have a specific proposal in terms of what should exist there, but I think it's important for us to think about if you have certain kind of conditions that are relevant to multiple settings, a hospital, a clinic, a nursing home, specific, you know, other specialty care settings, who's accountable? How do we deal with the measurement and accountability there? And then if there are multiple settings, is that in a place where a health plan should be the place for an accountability? And if so, what measure should be used for the accountability there, particularly in some cases where a health plan really can't assume full responsibility for something that happens in every hospital, yet at the same time there is a systemic responsibility, I think, that the health plan has.
Great. Anne-Marie?
Just on the issue of just looking at ICU data, our system, we really do look at the CLABSIs all over, and it actually, the ICU can be great, and the units can be a problem, or the units can be great and the ICU can be a problem. So we're not getting a consistency between the data. I mean, it's just one hospital system, but we don't get a consistency in the data. So I think you have to scan the whole inpatient service in order to really know. And an estimate would be nice in terms of decreasing the workload, because it is hard to gather up all those days. But I think it would be a mistake to just think if the one unit is really a picture of what's going on kind of everywhere. And then just in terms of this list, I think you could, even if you kept some of the skip, you could kind of drop off some of the others because some of these are repetitive. And even the cardiac, I don't know why kind of the cardiac prophylaxis is a separate issue. I mean, I don't know that you have to do that. We tend to be looking at some wider issues of the data. So those could, I think, be dropped. Even if you kept some of the skip measures, you don't have to keep all of these ones that are listed here. You could, you know, thin that amount down. And then just one other point on looking at the continuum of infection. I mean, I know this isn't us, but I'm assuming that the outpatient people will be looking at vaccination rates for adults, because I think one of the key issues here is like flu vaccinations and pneumococcal vaccinations and shingle vaccinations and all those vaccinations, which we still don't have great numbers on in the adult population. We do well with the kids. So I'm just saying that if you're going to think about infection in the continuum, a big thing is to stop it up front, and maybe just to those groups, I'm assuming those will be in there from the outpatient people, but vaccination rates for flu and pneumococcal pneumonia are still not great in many places. I think that's a critical issue if you want to stop infections, you know, before they start.
Great. Nancy?
Thanks. And I want to agree with Anne-Marie that in fact, I don't understand why you'd have the Society of Thoracic Surgeons prophylactic measures on here if you have the generic surgical administration of antibiotic ahead of time, unless there's something I'm missing about this measure. I'd rather have the broad-based measure that incorporates the cardiac surgery and not call it out specifically. But secondly, I just, since a number of people have mentioned the hospital-acquired conditions, I just wanted to go and remind us of why last year we said that they weren't good enough to be part of this set, which was that while they sound like good ideas, that the data from which they are culled, the billing data, does not give you an accurate read or even an estimate of the true incidence of these conditions. And I don't remember the data off the top of my head, but there were something like 500 or 600 hospitals that in CMS's data had no catheter-associated urinary tract infections based on the information they were able to cull from their bills. And I would love to tell you that was true, but I can honestly swear to you without setting foot in any of those hospitals that that's not true. And so we support the use of the NHSN data, which is reliable and derives people effectively towards addressing these safety issues and to identifying other measures that accurately capture the incidence of these events so that we can drive safety forward. But trying to pull this stuff from billing data is just gives you a false read.
Tom?
A couple little points, and that's the nice thing about having the tent card up is you can hear other people and you can comment on what they said. First place with Anne-Marie and everybody else, I agree with you. The experience that we have is that the site of service, the ICU, is different than the rest of the hospital. And so I'm going to get kicked over here, but I'm not going to agree with that. So it does need to be generalized across the hospital. Secondly, regarding adult immunizations, right now that's captured from not from claims-based data, but it's survey-based data. And so this becomes a gap then in being able to accurately capture the right kind of information. It becomes more a test of the patient recall as to whether they got that shot or not. And I have to keep a card now so I can remember it myself. And then as far as health plans go, it is important to be able to measure health plans just because we all have different degrees of accountability for different elements. With these kinds of things, it's much more of a population basis where health plans should be monitored, and I think we've got more opportunities for the ambulatory side to be able to provide support than we do on the inpatient side. But again, that's part of the point of coming up with these families, is being able to identify the level of responsibility and accountability so that we can take care of these patients, these members.
Richard?
First, I want to support what Nancy said. I do believe that we need the NHSN definitions. Even though they're harder to obtain, they have credibility and hospitals feel they're actionable as opposed to the ICD-9 coded measures. Also, with regard to the process measures, you know, the reason I feel we do not need to look at the bundles for the ventilator and the central line infection is if you're measuring these things pretty well, you're going to see them. You know, you're obviously internally you should be looking at this. Are you following the bundle? Which elements are you missing? That's going to drive your rate down. I'm not sure we need to report that publicly if we have the objective rates. The same is not true on the infectious, the post-surgical infection site. That is an infection that may occur 2 weeks after the patient leaves. We're going to miss it. And I do think looking at that antibiotic administration and stopping that antibiotic administration has been very, very effective in bringing down post-surgical infection rates.
Jane?
I have a question, and it's, does the NHSN surgical site infection measure have a timing post-op that goes out? I know one of them went out a year post knee replacement or hip replacement, and are we talking about including that?
It's been a while since I've looked at the definition, but at least for implants, for surgical procedures where there was an implanted material, the surveillance was supposed to occur up to a year after. So you're right about that. One of the challenges, and this is why it's been so important to work with the American College of Surgeons in revising definitions and thinking about the methods, is how do you do the post-discharge surveillance, and what do you count? Do you count in your SSI rate, do you count post-charge surveillance, or do you only account for those most serious infections that occur during the hospitalization or require readmission? So there's been some back and forth about what to include, and I'm a little more removed from that, so I don't know what the specific discussions have been lately. But all of those issues are being discussed with American College of Surgeons to try to harmonize the approaches.
Ron? You've been waiting so patiently.
Oh, that's because I was sitting over working on what Anne Marie commented on. I agree, I was going to do it if she didn't. I think I had to check to see if it was an endorsed measure. 431 influenza vaccination coverage among healthcare personnel should have been on this. It is a patient safety issue, no ifs, ands, or buts. You can't come. We just don't think of it as far as healthcare acquired infections. It is. It's some employee of someone making a sick. And I think it's written in a way to cover all the care settings, every single one of them, I think. CDC is the steward, and they specifically allude to every place we could possibly talk about. So I think we do have to make a strong point of that needs to be on.
Okay. Amy?
I have two things, because that just reminded me of one. I thought there was an issue with that measure covering only direct employees and not contracted employees, and that to me would be a gap, because that's a huge section of the workforce that's not being accounted for. The other question I had, when we're talking about the NHSN measures, are the results of those measures available generally to the public or to the purchasers? I know from CDC it seems like, you know, it's kind of only available to healthcare entities or state public health departments.
Chesley?
So the NHSN exists and has existed based on a confidentiality agreement that's signed with the hospital. So that's where you have to start in this discussion, because it's complicated. In 28 states, very good consumer efforts have taken place and have required public reporting. So in those states, for the conditions that have been spelled out, were in these public reporting laws. Those are publicly reported by hospitals. And then for those conditions that are tied to Medicare payments, those are publicly displayed by hospital and hospital compare. So it covers many of the important ones, but there are a subset that are not publicly released, and that's because of the way that the arrangements have been set up with the hospitals. And you can argue with that, but that's the way it's evolved over the years. I wanted to go back to another point, but I forgot what it was, so I guess I'll come back later.
Reserve the right. Randy?
Yeah, no, number 138, catheter-associated urinary tract infections. It indicates only locations where patients reside overnight are included. Is there any reason this could not include home care?
So a gap would be to expand this one outside its current setting.
Yeah, I'm looking at that. I mean, this is one that could be, that could include ambulatory or home care. Trying to find others that could.
I'm looking, what I'm seeing down here is not got home care. It's got LTACs and rehab.
Yeah. I suppose the ventilator associated one could include LTACs in a limited way, but they're very limited. But I think we should look for some things that, that get past facilities if we can, and that's where the urinary catheter one is one that should be able to. Sorry?
The class B is specified the same way. Would you say that?
I think so. Standardized infection ratio, I believe that could be applied to home care.
Okay. Dolores?
Just a question and a comment. First of all, it seems to me that the purchasers could be very helpful in getting some of these data that are currently not available simply by including them as performance measures in their procurements. And one of the things that I as a purchaser at least find is that I'm kind of, you know, sailing alone and making up things that, for all I know, you know, something like this organization could help me out by saying, look, why don't you ask for these measures? And, you know, there's nothing like the fear of losing a contract to enable a health plan to decide, well, yeah, they could do it after all. And we'd be glad to help. So that's an offer of assistance for the, for a gap area. Secondly, do I not recall in terms of the infections that are related to hip replacements and the like, that this problem has been solved by the Europeans who mandate that in, manufacturers have registries in which, you know, they, I don't know whether they brand it, you know, their each device so that whatever happens to its ultimate recipient is tracked and they know where they are and they know where there have been infections. I read it somewhere, so it must be true. But but I gather we do know such tracking here in this country and that it is, this is maybe, if not a solvable problem, at least a trackable one if we put our minds to it and push those manufacturers to do this. It's in their own interest, isn't it? Maybe, maybe not.
She's looking at me. Is that a question for
you? Yeah. No, because I think you were mentioning about
well, I mean, I think that there are approaches like that. I think this is an FDA issue, too, because FDA is very interested in not only PIPs, but a lot of medical devices and how they're tracked. There isn't a consistent way to track them. And even the infection surveillance that we're so proud of at CDC doesn't tell you how that infection is related to a particular type of device. So if there are multiple devices that a physician or a surgeon could use, you don't really know whether there's a better infection rate. I do. Can I use the floor?
Do you remember?
Yeah, I do remember what the point
Welcome
I
Welcome back.
So on the surgical site infections, one of the problems with surgical site infections that we've all alluded to is that once a person is discharged, especially with our very short length of stay or ambulatory surgical facilities, that the infection could actually happen, you know, weeks to months after that. And that's really hard in terms of data collection and being able to collect it. I do think, I'm not knowledgeable about this, but I do think that's where payers could help. Because if you think about payers having a system following a person over a set of claims over a period of time, if we could come up with a way to utilize the claims data and supplement it with clinical data, that would be a way to really get to a better level of surgical infection and maybe other adverse events that might actually give us what we really want to know. Because what we really want to know is what's happening to that patient after the surgery, not just while they're residing in the hospital, but longer term. So I just throw that out as a developmental idea. I just want to throw that out as one of the things that maybe this group could think about for the future we could do.
Nancy, you were coming back on the joint conversation?
Yes, just to provide a little further information on Dolores' comment, the FDA does and has for a long time had a database that tracks adverse outcomes related to devices. We believe that, and it's one of the reasons we supported the new law that allows uniform device identifiers to be basically barcodes to be put on all sorts of devices so they can better track that. They weren't getting as much reporting as they probably
should have gotten, and this will help a lot because it allows them to then automatically separate the kinds of devices and the manufacturer so they can really track to see if it was device A or device C or whatever. But it does exist, so we don't have to reinvent that particular wheel.
Well, just in full disclosure here, that the FDA is working very closely with the Orthopedic Association in developing a national joint registry, and it's for more than tracking joint infections, but they want to track, you know, joint longevity and, you know, what's the replacement rate, what's the short-term replacement rate, et cetera. Yet that's going to take some time to bring up to speed, and it was about a month or two ago we actually kicked off a meeting here with about 200 thought leaders in total joint replacement, sponsored by the Academy of Orthopedics and very strongly encouraged by the FDA. So it's moving directly to what you had mentioned, Dolores. We're just not there yet. Lance? That's what they need. Believe me, they need it. They need more than an agent.
Or maybe an agent provocateur might be more accurate.
Comment certainly support the inclusion of the healthcare worker or personnel flu immunization metric. And getting back to Amy's question regarding which populations it covers in the hospital, Chelsea, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that particular metric is being retooled so it does include not just direct employees in the hospital, but volunteers and other non-direct personnel. So I think that measure will be much improved. The other comment I wanted to make, and this kind of hinges off Nancy's comments, and that is that if we decide to include the process measures, the SCIP process measures, SCIP 1, 2, and 3, I noticed on our list that we have OP7. So on the inpatient side, we have the SCIP measures, but on the outpatient side, we have these OP measures. We have OP7 in there, which is antibiotic selection for surgical patients, but OP8 is missing, and I think that's the counterpart to another one of these SCIP measures. And if I'm not mistaken, I believe OP8 has to do with the timing, 1 hour prior to incision. I'm not entirely positive on that, but I think that's the case. And if we just, again, if we decide to include the inpatient process measures, we might want to include OP8 in this bucket.
So it's extreme. I can't tell you how hard it is as a surgeon to keep your mouth shut. And I really enjoyed, you know, this conversation, which has had a strong surgical focus. But from what I've heard from the group, it seems really clear that very strong to keep all the outcomes tracking. I don't really hear an exception to that. So clear message, don't even need to go there. Little more question, though, about the role of the process measures in this. To me, I see the process measures from the surgical viewpoint in that there's been a huge effort in these process measures, and they're very topped out in many levels. And yet we don't see big improvement in surgical site infections. So I think the causes of surgical site infections lie somewhere else. And putting our big efforts into those process measures isn't necessarily going to change the SSI rates. But tracking SSI rates will get people to look at what are the meaningful processes. There is, however, one process that I think is an important patient safety process, and that's the discontinuation measure. I have real concerns that if we were to just stop the SCIP tracking, that there would be a resurgence of expansion of inappropriate extension of antibiotics. Patients would stay on medications much longer than they need to, and those lead to resistant strains. It leads to other complications for those patients related to the antibiotics that there's no proven benefit for them. So I almost look at those measures as a huge safety issue. And so I want to say that the outcome measures, I think we're clear on. but I'd really like to get some of your thoughts about these. Do we keep these process measures? Are we selective about the process measures that we keep, or do we just step away from the process? And that's about as surgical and deep as I want to go because of my own bias. Jane?
In addition to that, Frank, I was thinking, Sean referenced earlier sample sizes for smaller hospitals that don't have these outcomes and the volumes that might be meaningful depending upon how the measures are going to be used. Maybe having process measures and their compliance with process measures would be informative. That would be potentially another argument for including process measures.
Okay. Richard?
Yes. I completely agree with your comments about the cessation of the antibiotic, because even with the measure, we have trouble getting some physicians to stop the thing because of religious reasons. But I would like to caution, if we do that, if we keep that measure, we really should, I think strongly about keeping the antibiotic measure given within 1 hour, because the easiest way to score well on that measure would be not to give the antibiotic. Right? So I think we need to make sure we don't have a perverse incentive. And I really do think that having that measure has made a difference in terms of the patients who get that antibiotic within the hour, which is known, I mean, by the data, to really decrease the infection, postoperative infection rate.
Randy?
I mean, a lot of these process measures revolve around prophylactic antibiotics in various contexts, timing, administering physician selection. I don't think that that's the 90% of the issue on surgical infections is prophylactic antibiotics. I don't think we need this many. It's not that I don't like process measures, although I certainly prefer outcomes measures, but I don't think we need prophylactic antibiotics in 8 or 10 different forms. I think we could be a little parsimonious, if you will, on that, if we're going to include them. Maybe one or two.
Okay. Amy?
I was just wondering if this lends itself to a composite measure, appropriate antibiotic use, and just for future development, if we were going to keep them in, if we just kind of smush it all together.
Great. Sean?
Yeah, I was just going to echo that. That actually might be a very good composite measure. I think you're absolutely right, Frank. I think the starting of antibiotics is so ingrained in surgical care right now that I'm not sure that a measure is making a difference. When we did our 5-site multi-studies of hip fracture over a decade ago, we actually looked at that as a quality measure. We couldn't use it because everybody was doing it. It was just routine care. But I do agree with you. I think the key issue is stopping them now. And I think that is that type of composite measure, but appropriate antibiotic use may be the way to go.
Is Nancy?
So I guess most hospitals are measuring these things already. So it may not be an additional burden, but if we really don't think it's having a dramatic effect on practice because people are already doing this already, I'm not sure that rolling it into a bundle has any big effect either. Just one voice against the bundle, but I do agree that we need to keep the measure on stopping antibiotics. My heartache is over the fact that we only have surgical site infections for the 2 major surgeries. And I really think we need a strong statement in here that needs to move forward as rapidly as possible to expand to other conditions because we need to be measuring them.
And I want to suggest there may be a way of solving the conundrum if all you do is look at the discontinuation. If the denominator is this patient should have received antibiotics and were they discontinued, you're going to get those that should have gotten them to begin with. And so it would get to appropriate use. It would take some tweaking of the current measure because they're kind of paired the way they're written now. But it could be rewritten that here's the list of those who should have gotten it. They're now on the list of those who we assume got it and you should have had an order to discontinue. If you didn't have an order to discontinue because they didn't get them, you're going to get hit too. So either way, you're damned if you do or damned if you don't. Jane, are you? Chesley?
No, another way to think about it is that the discontinuation measure is really not an SSI measure. It's really a medication overuse measure. I mean, that I was on, I worked with the CMS people 10 years ago when we did the SIP project before the SCIP project, and that's the way we thought about it. That third measure was really one that was addressing the antibiotic resistance issues, not so much the SSI.
It's truly a safety measure.
Yeah.
All right. So the last thing we have to consider between you and a break are gaps, because I think we've got a pretty good sense of putting together something for you to react to in regards to these. We've mentioned immunization. We've mentioned outcomes expansion in critical areas. We've mentioned events. And I'm wondering, are there other areas that we need to consider as gaps to include in this area? And Tom?
As I mentioned before, I really think that in the urinary tract infection, the catheter one, that you can divide things up because there are different issues in the ambulatory side for the person with a long-term indwelling catheter, in the LTAC side, on the floor, and in the ICU. So you can start getting a whole host of measures and create a family.
Great.
The stream team.
Richard?
Frank, I don't know how we do this, but I think we need to encourage a measure on the early identification and effective treatment of sepsis.
So the I think that's critical, and we had a sepsis discussion earlier this morning that we didn't lose, and I think we will be looking at sepsis not within these 2 days, but very shortly. We may need to have a call on it. We may put it ahead of our July agenda. But that came through loud and clear. There are some measures that we do have, but I think there's some homework as we looked at them. There's some homework we have to do to prepare those for the committee to look at. So please just allow us some time to get that work done for you. But I will keep that on our, not so much on our gap list, it's on our to-do list. We will do that and hopefully get that to you before you know, we have to get all this submitted. Barbara?
Yeah, we talked about developing a methodology to do post-discharge follow-up on infections.
Thank you. Bill?
We want to reiterate on the need for on SSIs, the need to expand that beyond, the initial two procedures, or some way of getting a broader set of outcome measures on SSIs. The other suggestion would be on the ventilator-associated pneumonia measures. One of the limitations of that outcome measure is that it's limited to the pediatric population, so expanding that to the adult population would be a good thing to do. What's missing is a good outcome measure for.
So the outcome measure in PEDS, get that expanded to adults.
Right.
And the procedure-specific SSIs, as well as the site-specific SSIs,
right,
with those procedures.
Right.
Okay. Dolores?
If the data sources for the HAC measurements are inadequate, should not that be identified as a gap, that somebody ought to go out and figure out how to get better data resources. I mean, rather than just saying, well, the data aren't very good, too bad, maybe that's a good job for somebody to do.
And I think there's some efforts there, but I think it's a great point for us to refine in our comments. Nancy?
So I think we talked about this before, Frank, but I just want to make sure it's on the list that the surgical site infection measures, whatever we end up with, to the extent that they are appropriate to the ambulatory surgery centers and to the office-based procedures, ought to be expanded to those two settings. As Chesley and his colleagues are developing this ventilator-associated event measure, the
long-term acute care hospitals have got to be part of that target population, I think.
Thank you.
Yeah, no.
Richard?
Yeah, I just want to build on that by also saying that, you know, infections and antibiotic use, problems don't just start in the hospital and then you follow it. They in fact, start in other places as well, and including in nursing homes. And I want to add kind of other settings here besides the hospital and the ambulatory care setting. If our focus here is on health-associated infections as opposed to hospital-acquired conditions, we want to extend it beyond the surgical, then I think we need, you know, really to look at across the full spectrum and not just assume it starts in the hospital, but that, in fact, these kind of problems can start in other settings as well. And there's a gap here in terms of dealing with the measurement of that.
So to me, that's a very broad gap.
Yes.
And, you know, it's all of chronic care and post-acute care. The same kind of intensity that we've applied to the acute care setting, we've not applied to the chronic care setting near enough. So an overall gap is to get this level of intensity of infection and outcome-related reporting in chronic care environments and acute care environments. Post-acute care, I'm sorry. Nancy, are you... Barbara, are you up? Okay. You got a break. Let's take 10 minutes and reconvene. All right, let's try and grab our chairs again so we can get through the rest of our agenda.
Thanks, Frank. Hello?
Hello?
Hi, it's Andrea. Can you hear me?
You're very low.
Oh, really? Is this better?
Yes.
Sorry, I'm like huddled in the corner here. I do have some comments about that last piece. Or do you want to hear them, or do you want to wait? What's your plan there?
Oh, this is a good time.
You know, if I think about the two things when I think about the pediatric stuff that I think are really important to have recognized are that the VAT metric, the ventilator-associated pneumonia metric, and I didn't hear Chisley's earlier comments. I think I heard most of the last session, but that metric, my understanding is that that's the same NHSN metric that on the adult side has been so problematic and has been similarly problematic on the pediatric side. And the work that actually needs to be done to create a solid outcome measure for pediatric VAP is the same work that has been going on to create the ventilator-associated complication metrics for the adults. Those adult measures for ventilator-associated complications cannot be just applied to the pediatric side because of some of the dependencies. And in pediatrics, those measures need to account for mean airway pressures and other things that are different than on the adult side. So that metric actually needs to be appropriately built on the pediatric side. The existing old metric has the same problems that the other existing old metrics had and could not be put forth for this use. But what should be said is that we do need to develop the appropriate pediatric measure, much as the work has gone into developing the appropriate adult side measure. That's my comment on the VAP metric.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
I have a similar comment about the C. diff metric. One of the things, and I see that this metric is built as a SIR, I'm not familiar with working with this metric in particular, but it is a lab event metric, which means that it's basically the FIR for the positive lab results. If I'm understanding it correctly, it does not take into account the clinical scenario of the patient. In children under 2, 50% of them are colonized with C. diff, and even in children older than 2, you know, up to 5% can be colonized. So when you think about C. diff in a child, you really have to think about it tied tightly to the clinical scenario. And so even accounting for it with an SIR, I don't think it's appropriate to have a lab-based C. diff metric be applied across pediatrics in that way. At the very least, some you know, pediatric infectious disease experts would need to weigh in and determine the best manner to apply a metric like that, whether those are age breakpoints or other clinical conditions that get added to, you know, other clinical manifestations that would get added to that. So I have some concerns that this metric only excludes neonates and doesn't exclude children up to, you know, even 5 years of age. So I think that that C. diff metric has some issues, although I'm obviously supportive of, you know, outcome measures in general. And then my third comment is around, and I think that this is now off the table if I understood the conversation properly. I think when folks were talking about process measures, they were talking about the SCIP process measures, but this list does have these bundle compliance process measures on them. And in particular, these are, you know, exceedingly difficult to measure and standardize meaningful manners. And so I would support the other comments that that talk about taking those particular process measures. I'm looking at 0464 and 0298 off of the menu, so to speak. So those were my thoughts, particularly about the pediatric side of things.
Those are all helpful. Thank you so much. All right. So we're now going to move on to the injuries from immobility. And again, we'll walk through our protocol that we've set up, but I'm going to deviate just briefly for a moment because these measures have undergone significant activity inside the measure endorsement process. Before our commenters had a chance, I thought we'd get an update from Bill, and then we'd go to the commenters. So if I could, Bill.
Okay. Yep. Yep, but you may want to take your legal size, Doc. There's four areas where last week the steering committee paired or bundled items. So I'll go through that slowly, and you might want to put some brackets around your sheet. The implication of pairing is the measures need to be used together, but you still get separate rates reported. But the pairing decision requires dual use. So 141 and 202, the first two fall items, are a pair of related to inpatient falls. The next item, 266, stands alone. That's an outcome measure of falls in ambulatory care. And on the next page, 674 is a fall outcome measure for long-term care facilities. Our committee did not review that one. The next item, 35, stands alone. It's a patient survey asking them if they were assessed for falls and given a plan if they were at risk. Our next bundle is item 101 and the following one, 1733. And then on the next page, the first item, 1730. So 101, 1733, and 1730 were bundled together as a, is this one home care? It's an ambulatory set of measures around screening and developing a plan of care for ambulatory patients with fall risk. 537 is a standalone home health care assessment. And our final bundle is in the pressure ulcer area. And it's the last set of measures, 539 and 540. And they have a lost sister, 538. So it's a bundle of three measures related to home care around assessing a patient, developing an intervention, and then developing a plan of care is 538. And that measure didn't make it to your summary sheet, but they're bundled together. So that's the lumping we did last week.
All right, great. So I appreciate it. Thank you very much. I've got Lance, John is not here, and Richard. So Lance?
Okay, I guess I'm going to come at this from a perspective from the hospital standpoint. That's where I mainly deal with. But in looking at the set of many measures, it's good to see that many of these measures cover different areas besides the hospital setting. When we're seeing ASC measures in here, long-term care, both long stay and short stay, and home health. So I guess in general, that's agreeable to see those measures in there that covers those different settings. These measures cover different data sources, different stewards, so there might be some concern there when we start talking about harmonizing these things. From a hospital perspective, this is where I might lend some more comments. I know that in the past, and I think right now some of the CMS hacks are still in play for both of these measures, both the falls and the decubitus ulcer. In particular, the CMS hack, the falls trauma, we have to remember that that hack is actually more than just falls. What's in there is fractures, dislocations, intracranial injuries, burns, and electric shock. So we have to remember if we ever are thinking about that particular measure and using it, there's more types of events in that measure than just falls. One of the things that we might want to do is if we use a measure like that where we're screening administrative data to find falls is that there are certain ICD-9 codes that are applicable to each one of these events, and they can certainly be split out. So, for example, you could actually come up with a falls with injury measure that just focuses on just the fractures and the dislocations, and you split out the intracranial injuries, the burns, and electric shocks. We had spoke previously about some of the limitations in dealing with and using the data sources, administrative data sources, and coming and using them in regards to the HAC measures. There are other measures that I didn't see in this list, and this might speak to some of the gaps that I see in here. And I'll just note some of these because we might want to consider these as a group to fill in gaps in the future. Within the falls domain, I didn't see PSI 8. PSI 8 is post-op hip fracture. What we need to remember about PSI 8, though, again, is screening through administrative data. I believe that one is not NQF endorsed. However, we should note that PSI 8 is included in the PSI composite score, the PSI 90. So that's the selected indicators for patient safety. We talked about that previously, and I think that's on the last page of our discussion guide. So we have to remember that PSI 8 is a piece of PSI 90. On the decubitus ulcer side, and we had talked about this, I think, last year, a good parallel to the hack would be PSI 3 for decubitus ulcer. And again, there I'll note that PSI 3, I believe that this one is also not NQF endorsed. It is also included in the PSI 90 as part of that composite patient safety score. PSI 3 is interesting because it's the adult counterpart to PDI 2, which is a pediatric decubitus ulcer, and that's on our guide. So we don't see this adult PSI 3 on this list. PSI 3, it's good to see that we have other settings covered within some of these decubitus ulcer measures, because one of the limitations with PSI 3 is that the literature shows that if you're screening hospital data for decubitus ulcers, something on the order of 60 to 80% of decubitus ulcers are happening outside the hospital. So they're mostly present on admission. So we have to keep that in mind. And that's where I think in terms of measurement gaps, we need to think about some way of strengthening the validity of the present on admission data that we see in administrative data sets. To my knowledge, I don't think there's any infrastructure right now for CMS or anybody else to really validate the POA data, and I think that's a linchpin to making sure that this metric is really reliable and valid in the future. So we have to remember that, especially in regards to pressure ulcer in the hospital setting. Other things you might want to consider, and I think this was a question that I saw in the guide, is in regards to pressure ulcers. I think there are four different stages of pressure ulcers. We might want to consider do we or do we not stratify by the staging types of pressure ulcers. PSI 3, if I'm not mistaken, just looks at stage 3 and stage 4 pressure ulcers. The falls, we might want to think about stratifying this metric using the ARC harm scale. And I think that was alluded to in the discussion guide also. That, I think, would help strengthen some of the quality improvement efforts in many settings. And I think I'll close right there.
Great. Thank you. A lot of valuable comments there. Richard?
Well, I didn't have my card up, but I do have a comment. I like the concept of measuring falls. It's very important that we do that. I'm sitting here thinking about how do we get that data? Where do we get it from? Because the ICD-9 claims data for falls is not all that great. There's a V code for falls, but you know, people use that to varying degrees. So then we'd have to rely on self-reported data, which the Office of the Inspector General's report indicated is not very good. And then even if we do that, trying to get the data on falls that occur without any injury is going to be particularly difficult. So I think these are good things that are sort of aspirational, but I'm not sure if we are in the position to actually collect this today.
Well, let's open up this for discussion. There's again, a lot of outcomes and mix of process measures. The level of analysis is a little different. We're migrating away from acute care a little bit more into some other care settings. And I'm going to rely on your expertise to help guide us as to where we think the big safety issues are in creating that continuum here. Richard?
A couple of comments. There's always a shadow side to every strength, and one of the shadow sides of the quality here is that it extends beyond the hospital setting and involves lots of different settings. That's the good news. The bad news is the measures are different for each of the settings, and that, I think, causes problems. So finding ways of dealing with some standardization here in terms of what a fall is and what the issues are and what's the appropriate approach here, I think, is important. It also raises questions about reporting compatibility. I know that there's a dual subgroup, and there are other later opportunities for dealing with coordination of care, but I think this is a place where there's an important point to stress in terms of the compatibility between how Medicare and Medicaid approach issues of falls. Anytime you have an acute care setting and a long-term care setting, those two different jurisdictions get involved. And so pressing some compatibility on the Medicare and Medicaid side is important. And then the third thing I want to point out here is in looking at what different states are doing in terms of advancing dual integration and 20 different state initiatives, as well as what's being done in the Innovation Center at CMS, medical homes kind of are a new place where a lot of expectations exist for ongoing management of care for people with chronic conditions that involve multiple settings. And it seems to me like we, may want to think about how these measures fit in terms of expectations for medical homes and interdisciplinary care teams for addressing these particular issues.
Just to help us, because this could become a little bit more complex than we want. We've got falls and we've got pressure ulcers. Why don't we focus on falls and consider the efforts that were made in bundling, and then ask our questions of which of these measures do we feel are the safety measures that we want to put in our core set. Randy?
Thank you. I think I touched on this earlier this morning, but there, as far as the falls measures are concerned, there are a lot of bad things that can happen from the fall, but a very common catastrophe is the hip fracture, and again, 25% are fatal. If we're going to be evaluating for falls, we should also be evaluating bone density in most cases, and we shouldn't leave that out. I have to believe this must have been discussed at some point before we got to these measures to this point, but we think we can evaluate fall potential and prevent falls, and there is considerable evidence that we can. But there are also at least many cases where we're not actually preventing the falls; we're delaying the falls. They're going to happen. They're going to happen anyway. And I think it's important that we can also prevent hip fractures by increasing by with anti-resorbs medication or other means, increasing bone density. And we shouldn't leave that out of this equation, because that may prove to be more important.
So we may not have those measures here. We can put it up as a gap, and if the measure is over in some other aspect of our different work groups, we'll pull it back
right
in.
Right. We should incorporate it into this measure. And this would actually be a care coordination measure, I suppose, if we put it in that context. But we really need to do that.
Thank you. Dana?
So comments is that, you know, falls are occurring with injury, without injury, and I think it's important to capture both. I think that those falls that occur without injury, I would consider kind of like near misses, and we need to make sure we're understanding about those types of falls. Falls are, you know, occurring across populations, I mean age populations, whether they're elderly or can be with pediatrics, and across care settings, and I'm glad to see that there are measures here from the hospital to the ambulatory setting and long-term care and home health. I also just want to bring up, too, that we have listed here that, you know, injuries from immobility and falls may not be as a result of immobility. That could be due to altered cognitive status, so just a point of clarification. So I think that the other aspect, too, is that the screening is important, and we do have the screening tools that exist today. Again, in the inpatient setting, it looks like also in the ambulatory setting that it's either out there or in development, and, of course, then in long-term care and home health care as well. So, again, I think there's some opportunity here with some of these measures that the measures could possibly be maybe redefined for the future that would be more cross-cutting for, again, populations or across care settings. But I think that to have these measures that, again, encompass the screening and prevention and then the actual occurrences as well. The last comment is that, again, I think from Richard's earlier remark is that I think how we collect the data today is that maybe we should not limit ourselves in terms of how the data may be collected in the future as related to measure. I mean, if there are measures that we need out there, but as related to the safety and prevention of falls, but how we collect it today is not the right way, then maybe we need to look at that for the future, but not let that hold us down as well as related to claims data. Again, I think about in an inpatient setting, home health setting, long-term care, that the screening and the document, if a fall occurs, that is documented by the nurse and may or may not be reported or documented by the physician. So we need to be thinking about that as well.
So, Dana, I want to come back to you in a minute, but I want to ask you, I was listening to you and looking at the list and trying to determine what you wanted on the list. I think the easier question is what I'm wondering you would want off the list, because there was a lot you covered there. So let me just come back to you, but let me put that question to you. are there measures here that are not safety or they're duplicative? And there was a lot of positive in what you said, but do I include them all or not? And I don't mean to put you on the spot now. I'll come back, but let you look, unless you already, do you have the answer?
I mean, I can think I can start to answer that, is that when we kicked this off and Lance, I think, gave us some information that some of these measures, as looking at them as single measures or standalone, we now understand that they are paired measures. So I don't know how that will look going forward in terms of will that be considered bundled or composite measures or whatever term that we use, but you know, are these going to be consolidated in some way moving forward from how we're looking at this today?
Bill, is the understanding I have is that the individual measure is reported, but all three of them are reported as a bundle.
Correct.
And they're not totaled up into a single composite score.
Correct.
Does that help?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Bill.
I do have some specific recommendations. And from consumer and purchaser perspective, and public reporting perspective, the outcome measures we think are much more valuable than the process measures. So we recommend having those first four fall measures publicly reported. I'm a little concerned that it's only four. They're very similar kinds of things. They differ primarily of the setting in which they're applied. So maybe for our future development, there'd be some work on developing a common measure of falls that could be applied across settings. We're going to include any process measures, the ones related to screening and the plan of care, 101 and 1733 seem most appealing, but I don't know enough about clinically about the linkage between those process measures and actual outcomes. And then wanted to support what Dana said about if there's a way in the future for figuring out a way to include falls with even without injury to be included, that would be a valuable piece of information.
So, again, the same question that I put to Dana.
141, 202, 266, 674, and maybe 101, 1733.
And 101, 1733 are paired with 1730.
Okay, so sure, 1730.
Okay. That's what I was looking for.
The maybe bundle.
All right. Nancy?
So I was going to ask for some help from Bill or Heidi, because I'm not getting from the brief description here what the real difference is between 101 and 1730. Because they look like 1730 looks like a slight variation on 101 to me that might be a replacement for 101, but you said they're paired, or tripled, I guess, since there are three of them.
Right. So let me pull them up to give you, to be sure I tell this correctly. But 17, or 101 is just screening. So did you identify if they are at fall risk? Yes, no. And then the risk assessment has additional information that you would assess the patient with. I need to pull up exactly what that is. I'm not remembering off the top of my head. But it gets into more specifics. You're right. The screening one, 101, is much more simplistic and just did you ask. The second one actually builds off of for the ones that are at risk. Have you done a risk assessment? And then the third part is the plan of care. I can get more. If you give me a few minutes, I can give you the specifics on it. I don't know if you remember it, Bill. I don't.
This is Aaron from NCQA, so I can also answer questions about those measures if you would like.
Thanks, Aaron. Go ahead.
Well, I'll just say that the screening measure is really used to determine the denominator for the next two measures. So the idea is that you don't want to do an assessment, a full risk assessment or plan of care for someone who is not at risk. So that's where the difference between screening and assessment comes in. Assessment is much more in-depth and says you are at risk of falling. Let's go through and identify all the risk factors. The screening is really just asking patients, did you fall?
Yeah. As a Jewish person,
I'm struggling this a little bit and putting it within a safety context because I look at falls in two ways. I look at sort of dividing, but, you know, falls on the stable geriatric patient really are a marker of gait disorder or something bad happening. And screening, assessment, and treatment is the same as I would think about screening, treating, and assessing for high blood pressure, for example. Falls in an institution or in the setting of an acute event seem to me to be a patient safety issue because something has dramatically changed that brings somebody in focusing on medical attention, and it's up to us to make sure that interventions are in place to prevent something bad from happening. But, you know, I've got a number of older adults who probably, you know, are at risk for falls and aren't going to use their cane or their walker the way I recommend it, or are been sort of plugging along and doing really well and have something happen to them in the community, or they make a misstep and they fall. I'm not sure that's a safety issue. I think that's an illness issue. I'm having a real trouble lumping that into a patient safety issue. And I'm wondering if the focus, if it's truly on safety, is it focusing on falls in the setting of acute event, falls in the setting to admission into an institution, or falls in the setting of a long-term care setting, rather than the screening and assessment of a chronic illness or chronic disease in the community?
Great. Richard?
What I'm struggling with is how can we get an objective measure, which is also a broad measure? And I think if we're going to publicly report and compare, we want to make sure we're comparing, you know, apples to apples and objective findings. So falls with a severe injury, maybe that's hard to ignore. Fall with a break, that's objective. The problem is it's very narrow. But I'm afraid if we become so broad that we're going to say, let's just capture all falls, there's a tremendous disincentive to underreport, because I don't know if the way I'm going to report a fall is the same way as Nancy's going to report a fall. And if I think that I'm going to be somehow not in a fair playing field, there's a tremendous, tremendous incentive not to report. So I don't really know how we do this, except I would say, well, for public reporting, we should try to be as objective as possible until we have better sources of data.
Randy, are you still in the queue? Okay. Dana, are you in the queue?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Dolores, welcome to the queue.
I'm thinking about what you said, but then I am thinking about something I read either on the plane on the way here or yesterday, I forget which, about what one hospital did about falls. And by tracking every fall, they looked to see what else was happening. And what was happening was during change of shifts, the nurses would meet in the break room in this, you know, just to exchange the appropriate information about how each patient was doing and so on, which meant that there wasn't anybody in the hallway. Once it dawned on them that that was the problem, they said, we'll have to have the shift change transfer of information take place in the hallway. You cannot go into the break room, and their fall numbers went down, you know, like a lead balloon. I understand the concern about underreporting, but if you don't start, that's how you build the base of information, and that's how you look to see. Well, I think this is about lean management, actually, and that I thought it was a fascinating article because it told me something about where you start when you have a known problem for whose etiology you don't know enough information. So I would say I'd rather err on the side of perhaps being unfair about collecting the data, looking at it, seeing what it tells you, and then developing strategies to take care of it.
Could I respond?
Sure.
I think it's an excellent point. I think that's exactly what we want to do. If I were the chief safety officer at an institution, I would want to know about each and every fall, no matter how minor, and I would want to create a climate where that the safe environment for that reporting to happen. My fear is that as we make everything public, we do exactly the opposite. Now I no longer can find out about those falls because
the staff is thinking, well, we don't want to report Mrs. Jones. She didn't fall. She slipped to the floor, or she slid to the floor. You know, and we do the opposite, because now I'm afraid that if I report and you don't, I'm going to be dinged. And so what happens internally for quality improvement is very different from what is needed for public reporting, in my estimation, and especially when the data are self-reported.
I'd give a prize to people who report. I mean, there are ways around that issue. I'd say somebody who never reports anything, you should fire, or, you know, or somebody who reports the most falls, you say, good for you, you get the day off next week with pay. I mean, there are ways you can handle those issues.
I agree, Dolores. No, I was going to say, the literature I've read says you have to create a culture of safety. And the culture of safety says you report, and you're not punished for reporting. There's no punitive side to it. They just want you to report so you can fix the problems. You can have your reports out in the hallway and that. So unless the United States of America creates a culture of safety, I mean, probably the federal level has got to come down from leadership on down. So it's not a punitive thing, then we'll get real reporting. I would also caution against self-reported, though, especially I think it's on one of the health outcome survey questions. I think it's about falls. And I think it's recall is really hard, cognitive disorders, et cetera, et cetera. I caution you definitely against self-reported data, but reporting in a culture of safety, it has to be done. It can't. We'll never get to a safe country unless we report it and fix it.
Sean? Just very briefly, I think we just need to be aware of the unintended consequences, because falls happen in frail older adults, and the easiest way to make sure that frail older adults don't fall is not to ambulate them and not to get them out of bed, which has implications all by itself. So we just need to be very careful about what it means in terms of publicly reporting falls, because the easiest way to fix it is just not ambulate people.
Okay, so everybody's all for moving all patients to the floor so they never fall. There we go. Yeah.
Don't laugh. That is a major intervention.
So, I need some action out of the group here. I'm hearing a lot in favor of outcomes. I'm hearing concern about making sure we get fair reporting. Kind of plus minus on the process, on the bundled set. It was not a no, but it was not an overwhelming endorsement on the three that were bundled together. And the gap of osteoporosis, if the measure is already there, it won't be a gap. But Nancy?
So I think for the bundle, my problem is that they seem to be low bar. Did you do the falls risk assessment? Did you plan? You know, if we can measure falls, that's where I think we want to be. And I'm struggling to figure out in all of these who the clinician is that this applies to.
The other part of that I don't want to lose was, and forgive me, Sean, if I misstate this, but it was that the process measures are more a chronic disease assessment than a safety issue, whereas
right.
The outcomes are more a true effort towards safety. That was the other argument I heard, and I'd never thought of it that way. If that's the will of the group, we can go with the outcome measure and make a comment about the process measure in our report, that we think these process measures, while good, belong more in chronic care assessment of the high-risk population rather than a true safety. Is that okay? Is there any – so let me ask then about gaps on falls. Amy, are you up for – am I overlooking you? I'm sorry.
I just had one quick question. It sounds like these were looked at fairly recently. Was there any discussion of being able to combine the outcome measures across the different areas of care, or did that not really come up?
No, I don't know if we put it in the report, but I mean it came up that we should look at a common definition of we even got into what is a fall. You can spend an hour on that too, but we should try and across these different settings eventually get into some common approach to measurement.
I'm sorry, Dana.
Respond to that, because it seems that there really would be opportunity. We think about, like, looking at the patient fall rate for 141, if it was expanded in definition to really fall, you know, with or without injury experienced by patients, you know, based upon the service, you know, the care area and how they define service, whether that be an inpatient admission, you know, discharge, a visit, you know, in the ED or a visit, you know, home health visit. I mean, there could be, I think, some commonality in terms of, you know, defining a measure that would be cross-cutting across all care areas. So that would just be one thought I would put forth for the
future. So it's a gap to expand.
Yep, exactly. Okay. Expand the definition to be more cross-cutting across the care areas.
Laura, is your part up?
Yeah, I was just going to say, and maybe we could suggest that we don't publicly report until some of these things are teased out and, you know, we have the measures more amenable to across the population, just the definition of falls, unintended consequences, et cetera.
That got Helen's heart up.
That got Helen's car.
Well, not publicly report, right? You know, maybe we do that a lot with measures. As you test measures, you wait, you look, and then you start publicly reporting.
I think the issue, though, for healthcare providers, what leads to under-reporting is not publicly reporting. It's the consequences for them within their institution. I think public reporting is just not even relevant there, so I wouldn't bring that into it.
Richard?
I think there are at least two gaps. One is the concept of the balancing measure, which I think is very important. That if we're going to measure falls, maybe we better measure it simultaneously with patients who are who are ambulating, you know, 24 hours post-surgery, so that we have some objective measures, and we know we're not creating perverse incentives. But I think another big gap is the availability of the data. And I do think, and I do fear, that publicly reporting data, which is based on the nurse or healthcare worker to disclose a fall, is going to lead to, as you said, it took an hour to decide what a fall was. There will be weekly fall adjudication meetings of the fall adjudication committee, where we will either, if you can choose your word, rationalize or scientifically, objectively declare why this was not a fault. I just think we're in a terrible position when we don't have objective data.
Any more gaps? Those are all great points, and we'll just roll that into the report, which leaves us 9 minutes on pressure ulcers.
What facility we're talking about. For instance, when I look at the first one, the CMS measure 181, percentage of patients who had an increase in the number of pressure ulcers. I'm assuming that's applied to a long-term care facility, not an acute care hospital. That in fact, the Joint Commission measured right below it would be the one more relevant to the hospital facility, but I can't tell from the labels.
Yeah, 181 is home health.
Home health. Okay, so facility is that definition. And the arctic cubitus ulcer is hospital?
Yes.
So one might suggest that 201 and 337 are similar measures, perhaps even competing measures. I won't go there, Heidi. I won't go there.
One actually says under 18.
So they actually are potentially two different populations you're looking at.
Pediatric and adult. Okay.
So we call those related, not competing.
Related, not competing. So my personal preference would be to go with the Joint Commission measure and to suggest it be expanded to the pediatric population, in large part because I find this to be one of those areas where administrative data is not very effective in identifying the incidence, and that we ought to be pressing for the more accurate data. So that's, Frank, there's one recommendation for you.
Okay. Sean?
My recommendation is to keep 181 and 201, which would include it. I think they're terrific outcome measures. I know that Lance raised the question about the fact that perhaps people would develop. There's the issue of not assessing early and missing it. I don't want to put words in your mouth, Lance, but the idea that some but I got to be honest with you, if you're getting assessed for a pressure ulcer that you get on discharge or later, you're going to be damn sure you assess really well when people come in to make sure that it was there when you came in. And it will have the intended consequence of making sure that appropriate skin assessment is done on the day of admission.
Richard?
I would agree with the 201. At least in 201, they specify the stage of the ulcer, which is important. Now, there is an issue that there's a disconnect between this and the CMS, you know, no additional pay, which is stage 3 or 4. So I don't know if we need to be consistent with that or not, or if it's gone to stage 3, that's way too late. But I just want to note that there is an inconsistency there.
Is that 678, measure 678, is that the one?
Measure, I thought it was.
Does 201 consistent?
I thought it was 201.
But then you mentioned another measure.
I'm talking, well, I don't know if it's on here, but there's a CMS currently, the no added pay for decubitus ulcer involves three of the so-called PAC. It's stage 3 or 4.
And that's just an alternative we need to think about. It would be in my family of measures to consider. PSI-3 is the adult version of PDI-2, which is on this list. And PSI-3 is this stage 3 and stage 4, is my understanding. Consider as present on admission, risk adjusted as inclusion, exclusion criteria.
So, Lance, you're saying we should add that as a consideration, the adult version of the 337 measure.
You know, a good pair in my mind, if you had to go with administrative data, would be PDI-2 and PSI-3 because they're both ARC patient safety indicators. They use administrative data, you know, well-maintained. PSI-3, remember I made the comment that PSI-3 by default is wrapped up into PSI-90, the composite measure, which hospitals are measured on right now. And I believe it's in the value-based purchasing program. It's proposed, I believe. So by default, if it goes through, hospitals will be paid differently based on their outcomes for PSI 3 because it's in PSI 90. So flip side of the coin is, you know, it's administrative data. We, you know, there's limitations to that. And, of course, I mentioned limitation that the present admission indicator is part of this PSI 3 and PDI 2, and I have concerns about the validity of the way present admission data is being captured by hospitals. Is it accurate? You have to put that information on every diagnosis code for a patient or a discharge record. So that in itself is a gap if we went with, you know, PDI 2 and PSI 3. And, you know, I haven't really looked at 201, this joint commission measure, but, you know, that would be, you know, a viable alternative to PDI 2 and PSI 3. And Nancy correctly points out that if you do use 201, you know, it'd be good to have a pediatric counterpart. And then you have to think about the staging, too. If it's stage 201, it's stage 2, 3, and 4. So is there room for improvement there? Do we want to look at the most serious events, stage 3 and 4? Or do you want to expand a little bit and include 2? So I think there's a lot of issues to deal with within these set of two or three measures here. But I think we've outlined the gaps and I'm not sure which way I would prefer personally.
That doesn't make me feel better.
The other thing to consider, too, is the ARC indicators, PDI 2 and PSI 3, they're geared towards use with hospital administrative data. So you couldn't easily use those measures in another setting, whether it's ASC, long-term care. I'm not sure if the Joint Commission measure might be more applicable to be transferred across settings or used in different settings. It might be. I'm not sure about that. So that might be an advantage to using the Joint Commission measure. Might be easier.
So if I broke this down further, is there any objection to the home health 181 as an outcome measure? And then there are hospital measures that are outcome hospital measures, and we could go with a combination that covers adult and peds, but we haven't decided what's the right combination, the Joint Commission or the ARC measures or the CMS measures. And then lastly, there is a set of process measures.
So, Heidi, I'm going to need your help again. So, increase in the number of pressure ulcers, is that from 0 to 1? Is that an increase? Or is it among patients who already have one pressure ulcer, they increase to 2, 3, or 4? Because if it doesn't include the 0 to 1, I find this a pretty challenging.
You're talking about 181.
181.
I'm trying to keep them all straight here.
Yep.
Hold on just a second.
The CMS outcome measure for home health, you said.
Yep. So, all right, it's the number of episodes, home health episodes, where the value is recorded, total number of stageable pressure ulcers, and that's at stage 1, 2, or 3, or 4, on the discharge assessment is greater than the value resulting from the start of the care. So it does look to see if there's an increase in the...
It's
getting right. Yep. It's just a strange way to phrase it. And so part of our labeling and our taxonomy, just to answer Helen's question, I'm sorry, Dan, I didn't mean to cut you off, but when we say facility, it's actually a broad term that we use. Then what we try to do is then classify the setting as well so that you know the level of analysis is a facility with the setting being home health care. That helps.
And Frank, can I just make a quick comment just
sure.
to kind of level set for folks at the table that it is standard of practice for nurses or patient assessment across care settings to perform a skin assessment and to perform staging for skin breakdown. And there are established, defined, standardized tools to do that as well, too.
I actually just had another question about 201. The day of the prevalence measurement episode, is that like a Joint Commission inspection? Would people, in order to measure under this, using this measure, would they have to look at everybody in the hospital? That sounds like quite an undertaking.
It's a more of a survey methodology that they take a certain day in the month that they pull the records and look there. Yeah.
Richard?
I guess I'd like to suggest that we be consistent, because I think it's going to drive the hospitals crazy if there are certain measures for which they'll be paid or penalized if the ulcer is stage 3, and then others if it's stage 2. And I just think that it's going to set up all kinds of confusion. So, and a stage 2 ulcer really just means any break in the epidermis. It could go down through the dermis. There's a wide range of what a stage 2 ulcer could be. So anytime basically the skin is broken, that's stage 2. So I don't know if we want to be so constrictive at this point. I just think, in my mind, consistency is a good thing when we're doing these measures.
And would you make a recommendation based on consistency?
Yeah, I would recommend that we adopt, well, I guess there is no measure here, but I would like something like the Joint Commission's 201, only stage 3, or I'm not stage 3 or greater.
Richard, but I think that is one of the measures CMS, the one you're referring to is one that CMS is proposing getting rid of, the HAC. So
getting rid of for IQR, but maintaining for the HACPOA program, I believe.
Maybe. They've yet to opine on that.
Well, but okay.
So does that mean you'd be more in favor?
I think we need a little more information, but I think it's an issue we need to tease out.
Well, one more effort to break the logjam. Is there support for the process measures that are here as part of the safety measure family? There were 3 of them, 2 of which are listed. Amy?
If I understood Dana correctly, it sounds a little like this is kind of standard of care and nursing practice. Not that these measures necessarily apply to nurses. So from that perspective, for me, I don't find it to be a useful measure. So I may be misunderstanding.
Okay. Well, I'm going to then leave the rest of this question on pressure ulcers. We may think about this one tonight, but rather than get stuck on it, perhaps we can visit this first thing in the morning after you've had more of a chance to think about it, but let's not let it clog us up. And we can move on to our last topic of the day, which is the perioperative procedural safety. And we've got comments in this, beginning with Barbara, and then Nancy and Chesley. And Chesley is had to run. All right, Barbara.
This one, you know, when I've explained to members of 32BJ what it is that I do when I come to Washington, wrong site, wrong side, wrong patient, wrong procedure, wrong implant, they get it. Now, I know that these are rare occurrences and they're hard to measure and the measurement is unequal and uneven and reporting from state to state varies and CDC gets what it can. But I really would like to argue very strongly for some kind of index that's constructed of these terrible mistakes that happen that are a really good indication of bad processes, as well as foreign object left in the body. I know that they happen rarely, and I know all the problems. I've taught statistics. I know all the problems with dealing with rare events that people that they report unevenly. But let me just make a quick plea for not excluding something because of uneven reporting. Some hospitals will hide their results. Some units will make sure that they don't tell their supervisors what's happening. All of that is going on, and everybody's going to find ways to game this. But if we put it out there that they're supposed to report, and some people do, we have a fighting chance of getting everybody else to do it. So I want to argue really strenuously against the notion that we should withdraw a measure because it's difficult to count and because a lot of people are going to game the reporting. So anyway, that's my short of Chesley. I don't have anything to say about the clinical arguments.
Just a quick question. You said an index. Are you suggesting these are bundled or put into a composite?
Put into a composite. Because obviously they don't happen all that often. But the fact that they do happen needs to be reported and needs to be reported to the public. I mean, that's the people who need to know about this. One of those things in our whole list, one of the few things in our whole list of things that people actually can understand. You know, they don't need somebody to interpret it for them. I got it.
Great. Nancy?
So surprisingly, I may be in a position similar to Barbara. I think we need a different way to think about these incidents than the traditional reporting that we've been talking about here with the measures and the data collection and so forth. But I don't think we need to lose them. I'm not sure these measures actually accurately capture what we need to know. And I do think that that's why we've got a variety of tools. So while it's not directly on point for the measure application partnership, speaking to the need to collect and use data on these rare events in an informative and an effective way, I think could be part of the safety work group's task. And quite frankly, reporting, one of these rare events per 6,000 incidents does anybody any favors. It doesn't inform them what their relative risk is. It doesn't inform them where they should go. It doesn't inform them in a lot of ways. But figuring out how to collect and use this data and talk about what needs to happen for improvement is important to do. And I would like to see us move in that direction rather than let's report the rate of this per hospital or per nursing home or per clinician.
Richard?
So I'd like to say I do think we need to measure and look for rare events, and I do think we need to look at some of these events like pneumothorax and accidental punctures. Even though not all of them are preventable, we still should probably look at them. My problem with these accidental punctures and iatrogenic pneumothoraces is with the denominator, because patients are only at risk for these things if they undergo certain procedures or if they're on high-pressure ventilation, if they've got a subclavian line that's placed, or someone's doing a thoracentesis. If I'm not having any of those, there's no way I'm going to have a pneumothorax. So we basically have a measure with the denominator and it's really denominator-dependent. If you don't do those things, you're going to have wonderful-looking measure, even if every time you did one, you punctured somebody's lung. That's an odd paradox, but that's what can happen. So I think we have to really consider whether we're measuring what it is we want to measure. That's the first question. And then once we do that, we can figure out, do we want to report these separately, form an index, or do it some other way.
Okay.
My sense is that the foreign body left in during procedure, wrong site,
measure and the burn are all things that would be responsive to a certification checklist and would hang together as a composite. Not that, I mean, I also think that the iatrogenic pneumothorax needs to be addressed, but my comment is relating to compositing the others.
Okay. Barbara?
Yeah, I agree with Nancy, except, and here's my except. I think that to the extent to which we are able to communicate to people that the hospital is not a black box, but that, in fact, there are things that go on in there that they can understand and they have a right to know about, is really critical. So I want to do both things. I want to help hospitals find ways to stop these things from happening, and maybe the checklist is the right way to do that. And I want to tell, obviously in responsible ways, purchasers and consumers what it is that's going on.
So is there anything on this list with the thought that right now we don't have any bundles, but is there anything on this list that you would not want on the safety list? Not one on the safety list. Richard?
Unless we can clarify what we're measuring with these pneumothoraces and punctures and make sure we're specifying the proper population, I would not want them on the list.
You're saying that measure?
Those four measures of pneumothorax and puncture. And if you tell me that, no, indeed, this pertains only to the at-risk patients, I'll feel differently. But I believe the way the measure is structured now, it's really looking at medical and surgical patients, and it's not limited to the high-risk procedures.
Doesn't ARC have special software for this that takes all that into account?
I could help in what the pneumothorax one is very narrowly defined by AHRQ, and Heidi's trying to pull up the details because I don't remember them right now, but it excludes a lot of what you may be concerned about. It does not count diagnostic procedures. It doesn't count routine surgical procedures. So what are the exclusions? Right. Well, it includes present on admission. Excludes any diagnostic code of chest trauma or pleural effusion. It excludes diaphragmatic surgery repair, any code indicating a thoracic procedure, lung pleural biopsy, or cardiac procedure. And
but who's in the denominator? That's my question.
All med-surg discharges.
Well, see, that's an improper denominator because half. I would say 90% of those people will have no chance of having a pneumothorax unless lightning strikes. You know, it's not going to happen unless they're having a high-risk procedure. So we've got to measure the right population.
Frank, if it helps, some of this discussion gets you into some of the anxiety the steering committee had on low-frequency events, and especially converting those to a percentage is actually an interesting. Was a little disturbed because a number of years ago they reported these as just counts, and then a prior steering committee made them convert it to rates. And now we're concerned about asking them to go back to counts, but that's beside the point. But if a number of things were lumped together so you could have a more meaningful rate report, it might be.
So just to be clear, these four measures, 344, 345, 46, and 48, all are tied to a denominator of all med surg discharges.
Yeah, it's by specific DRGs. I'm trying to pull it up, but it's hard to read it here.
Yeah, I'm looking at the technical specs now, too. It's in their appendices for the PSI technical specification. And as I look at it, it looks like it is a lot of DRGs for med-surg. I guess the critical question is it everybody?
And that I can't really tell, scanning through this list of DRGs. It's quite a comprehensive list. And if I'm not mistaken, I think the denominators are quite large when you use the software to measure these PSIs. So you might have a valid concern.
And I draw out to support distinction purposes, 368 shows you a post-operative event. There are lots of wound distances, but this measure is very explicit for those related to abdominal pelvic surgery. So there's a case where they narrowed the denominators substantially to try to get to the Richard's point of getting to the meaningful denominator group and then measuring the events related to that meaningful group. Bill?
I want to make a comment about the process. I'm very sympathetic to the point that you raised. We clearly want to measure this stuff in the right way. But I want to I feel uncomfortable for this group going through the process right now, saying particularly when our experts can't even quite find the denominator and we're making some assumptions about what's in and what's out. I would rely instead, I think it's wiser for us to rely on a process that's established in NQF to review this, make sure it's been, and if we have questions about it, we should ask those questions and raise them rather than making a decision here based on what we think is in the denominator. But it's a valid concern, and we should, if there is concern, we should raise it. What I feel very concerned about is I don't want us to come out with a recommendation saying we should toss out 344, 348, 345, 346 because of these questions. I think these are things that should be measured. If there's some technical fix that needs to be made or adjustment, we should recommend that. So it's one of these things we might recommend with an asterisk, that we recommend these because we think they're important. It's important information for both hospitals to have internally and for public reporting. And if the measure needs to be adjusted or fixed or the denominator needs to be redefined, that's fine. We can do that. But I'm a little wary of us going down this path of saying, since it's not measured exactly right, even though we're not sure, that we wouldn't include these in some list of recommended measures.
Nancy?
So there are a couple of pieces of information that I think we need to really effectively evaluate these. These claims-based measures will be much more affected than some of the others by the move to ICD-10. And I don't even know if ARC is respecifying these for ICD-10. They are.
They are, yes.
So there's that. There's the fact that CMS has proposed to eliminate some of these from the inpatient quality reporting system based on their own reliability studies, which we ought to pull up. I remember a wound dehiscence is one of those. I don't remember which of the rest of them have been proposed to be eliminated because they have tested out as being highly unreliable. And so there are some questions like that that I think we need the answer to before we can decide going forward whether there's any there. And then I really would like to propose we think about what Barbara laid on the table, which is there a way to treat these measures that is not the traditional approach of let's calculate a rate and put it out there per facility, per clinician, per whatever. Is there a more useful way to share the information with the public about what's going on here and how we should proceed? I personally am a fan of the way the state of Minnesota and the Department of Health in Minnesota reports similar rare events, but you know, whether you want to do that on a national basis or not would be something that I think would be a question here. But it is not the traditional rate base. It's back to the incident that, Bill, you said the previous steering committee dissuaded folks from using. But those are the questions that are in my mind, at least.
Jane?
Just the additional comment that the ASC measures that are listed, that the measures that are listed as ASC, that these could be across all surgicals.
settings, inpatient, outpatient surgery, as well as surgical centers.
So I'm hearing some angst, but at the same time, a real appreciation that these are very meaningful to patients, and it may not be actionable always at the delivery side, but they're very meaningful to patients to know that these are being measured. And then there are issues of the reliability and the quality of the measure given the construct for some of the specifications, but not all of them. So are there clear measures on here that you would say you like? And to the point that Jane had brought up earlier, there was a group you wanted bundled that was smaller than the entire group. The wrong side, wrong site, and what was the burns?
Burns, and then foreign body, left in.
And foreign body. So let me ask that as the first question. Across all the surgical settings, should we put forth a strategy that says in the safety group, we would like to see those measures, not necessarily composited, but bundled? And if at such point there's a composite developed, we would love to take a look at it. Those are the foreign bodies, the wrong side, and the burns. I'm seeing a lot of nodding heads, so I'm not seeing objections to that. Then that brings us back to the puncture, laceration, and the pneumothoraces, and the wound dehiscence, which truly are a different type of indicator of harm. And there's concern about the measure specs. But is there objection that these are measures that we wouldn't, if we had perfect specs, we'd want these or we wouldn't want them? I'm asking that question in view of the safety list. We would be saying that you have a culture of safety in your facility if you track in perfect measure world the punctures, the pneumothoraces, and the post-op wound dehiscence.
From the patient's perspective, I think they're very important.
That's what I'm hearing. Anne-Marie?
I think they're important from the clinician's perspective, too. I think that they're important things to track, it's so you know what your clinicians are doing. And maybe, I don't know if by tomorrow we could get a little more information on how these are calculated so we could say whether or not we wanted to put that asterisk with them and say we would like them to reconsider, some of the way it's calculated, but we do feel that they're important to measure. Or maybe we are happy with it if we could just get a little better picture of what's excluded, what's in, what's out, that kind of thing. Maybe by tomorrow. Is that possible?
We'll try.
Yeah, okay.
Richard?
So as I said, I think these are important things to measure. I just want to understand how we're measuring them, and it's really more, not to put you fine a point in it, but it's more than a spec because ARC's own usability panel had problems with this for the very reason that there is a high-risk population, and putting everybody in that denominator is really it fundamentally distorts the measure. So it's really almost a random number, and so that if we can just specify that it's being limited to those at risk, then I think that would be fine.
Why would it be difficult to have the denominator being surgical patients? It seems to me a fairly straightforward thing.
Well, the pneumothoraces that are risk may very well not be surgery at all.
Or to be people who've had the appropriate procedures.
Well, but it could be all the non-surgical patients are where all the pneumothoraces are occurring.
Okay.
And they're probably more likely in the non-surgical arena.
But following some kind of procedure that involves the chest, right?
Right. There could be placement of the central line. And in a scenario where they're not commonly placed is where they're commonly placed, you'll find an incidence. Where they're not commonly placed, you'll find very high incidence but a very low frequency. But that's what, to Richard's point, it's too big of a pot. So when you look at it, what does it tell anybody? It gets diluted by not having a narrowed enough focus. I mean, the other measure to me that's interesting from what Nancy was saying was about the abdominal wound, the abdominal pelvic surgery wound dehiscence. Very, very, very low frequency. But when it happens, it's a big event. And, I mean, that patient is at risk of all sorts of things. But it's a very, very low frequency. So tracking it, even as narrow as this measure is, I think it failed at the steering committee, and it's an ARC measure now.
I believe you're correct, but I'll have to go back and check.
I'm pretty sure it failed at the steering committee, but it persists as an ARC measure. And the reason it failed was the incidence was so very, very low. Everyone wondered, why would we track this?
So your comment about the placement of central lines in the pneumothorax makes me wonder if there's an opportunity as we drive down the infections from central line and central line placements, if there's an opportunity to think about sort of central line events that would include pneumothorax and or an infection. In the way Chesley was talking about, they're moving to thinking about ventilator-associated events, so you don't have to really kind of tease out those things, rather than lumping this in with the others.
It's an interesting question. I wonder, though, if the pneumothoraces are so low compared to the central line infection rate, it'll be very diluted again. Now we're diluting the numerator. So it's been a long day. All right. Last question on this area is to gaps in the perioperative measures, safety measures. Is there something we're missing? We're already making a blanket statement of wherever there is a perioperative environment, we would like to see these measures pushed across all the environments. So I think we've already captured that as a gap where that doesn't exist. We'd want the specs to go there. But are there other gaps that we're not capturing that we need to capture in the perioperative safety measures?
I'm wondering about the surgical safety checklist, the timeout. Is there a place for that here?
Yeah, that's a good one. Someone mentioned that earlier. We need to put that on.
Is this the place to put it?
Yep. And it's a measure that's out there, so I would wonder about putting that in the bundle group. I think that's what Jane had said earlier. Lance?
I was just wondering, since we have some ASC measures here that have to do with burns and if some other wrong side, I guess I don't see electric shock in here, but I was considering the how that maps onto the inpatient hack, and I mentioned this previously, where the hack is false trauma, and part of those traumas are things like burns, electric shocks. So I guess what I don't see here is I'm wondering if the hospital inpatient burns and electric shocks, there ought to be a measure for that parallels the ASC measures here.
Yes.
As a never event. They're just missing.
Okay.
And the wrong site surgery also is on the ASC.
Yeah. I guess going even farther, too, I wonder if there's an opportunity, you know, a long-term vision that we use the NQF safe never events, the list of never events, as a guide to this whole area on what we ought to be measuring across many settings, ASCs, inpatients. Because I have a feeling that these are just a subset of the different types of, you know, events that would fit into this category.
So we can look at those never events to see how they map within the...
Yeah, yeah. And then because they're never events, we know they're rare, and maybe there's some national infrastructure that we should develop such that we develop a culture of safety so that's okay for those on the floor to report these never events in a safe way that promotes driving these things to zero.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Nancy?
I don't know specifically what to suggest, but it struck me that there aren't any real, what I recognize as an anesthesia event on this list. And I'm wondering if there's things from that realm that ought to be added.
Excellent. Richard?
I'm also wondering if we should look at things like excessive blood loss. If we're going to look at surgical safety, wouldn't that be something worth noting?
Let me add to that. It's a difficult measure. I think I don't even want to call it a balancing measure. I think another view of the same coin is to look at transfusion, over transfusion. You're going to have blood loss in certain scenarios you can't avoid, but you shouldn't be overshooting the transfusion. And that's a real safety issue for patients. And there is variation in that.
Yes, and another area not directly surgical, but post-surgical, there are many problems with post-operative respiratory conditions, pneumonias, aspirations, et cetera, and maybe that's something we ought to look at and measure.
So perioperative blood loss, perioperative overtransfusion, perioperative respiratory events. All right. Anne-Marie?
Maybe this doesn't fit since these are around surgery, but the issue of injury during restraint on the medical side, I mean, I don't know that that's something maybe you want to consider in the future. But, you know, the agitated patient on the medical service who gets injured in the process of restraint, I'm not talking about psychiatric hospitals. I mean, it should never happen. It's a very rare occurrence. Maybe it doesn't fit.
No, it does. I'm trying. There is a measure, at least the Joint Commission has some activity in this area, and I'd have to go back and look at what it is, but it's dealing with altered mental status in the perioperative period, and it's trying to address whether this is an oxygenation problem, a medication problem, or a true mental health problem. Too often, it's assumed it's a mental health problem when indeed
right. It's
a physiologic event, whether it's hypoxia or over-medication. And the Joint Commission has a safety measure in that area. We'd have to look it up and see what that is. Very good point.
Good.
Jane?
And this is more a question, but what about things like unplanned admission after ambulatory surgical care or unplanned return to the OR or unplanned transfer to the ICU?
It's definitely a quality issue. Is there a safety thought in there?
That's a good point. It is quality.
I mean, if there is a safety one, let's pull it out, but it's not jumping at me. Shake?
I was just going to mention the pain management issue, too, but on second thought, I think that can kind of be rolled up into medication safety after surgeries or post procedures.
Richard, are you? And Jane, are you up still? What a great day. Let us open for public comment at this point. First in the room. And anybody on the phone?
As a reminder, please press *1 for comments. There are no comments.
So, Lindsay? you have your housekeeping?
I have a couple housekeeping.
Okay, go ahead.
Just a couple housekeeping items. One, if you hadn't already turned in to one of the staff the completed conflict of interest form, please do that. And